The fifth World Water Forum, being held in Turkey, has the slogan, Bridging Divides for Water. Yet the conference is organized by a corporate-led group whose members stand accused of creating, and then profiting from, limiting access to water. Those corporations include Coca-Cola, Nestle, PepsiCo, and the French multinational Suez. Support for a human right to water is being kept out of the forum's final statement. Meanwhile, activists peacefully protesting outside the World Water Forum have been tear-gassed, jailed, and deported.
Police say 21-year-old Eric Montagnez with the group Food Not Bombs broke the law by feeding more than 25 people as Orlando's ordinance allows.
Not against the law to feed people, and as much as they want to criminalize the help of the homelessness.
Undercover officers worked surveillance and counted how many people Montagnez fed, 30.
So Orlando police say they are simply enforcing the laws.
Montagnez faces a misdemeanor charge for feeding a large group in a city-owned park, and according to police, no organization had obtained the required permit.
Let us look back at last week in radical efforts, and the following is this week in radical history for the week starting March 23rd.
There is something going on in the east side.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in radical history for March 23rd, 1842, Congressman Giddings of Ohio is censured by the House of Representatives for introducing resolution opposing slavery and coastal slave trade. The gag rule, first adopted by self-dominated Congress in 1836, pledges every member not to mention slavery issue on the floor of the House. But freedom.
On this day, March 23rd, in 1889, U.S. President Benjamin Harrison declared that in 1 month's time, on April 22nd, vast amounts of land in the Oklahoma Territory would be open for settlers to claim homesteads upon. Oklahoma was initially set aside as a destination for Native Americans who were forcibly evicted or coerced from their ancestral lands east of the Mississippi. The opening of Oklahoma created what was called a land rush as prospective homesteaders stampeded across the state line at the prescribed hour.
Also March 23rd, 1967, in Bolivia, Che Guevara's guerrilla group experienced its first battle of the Bolivian campaign. The U.S.-backed Bolivian president appeals to the nation to, quote, join the fight against the foreign and local anarchists with arms and money from Castro's communists, unquote. Also 1970, President Nixon declares a national emergency, orders 30,000 troops to New York City to break the postal wildcat strike.
In 1982, a coup occurred in Guatemala, replacing the democratically elected president with a military commander, Efren Rios Montt. Montt was a graduate of the U.S. military terrorist training school facility called the School of the Americas in Columbus, Georgia. And like scores of other graduates of that fine institution, Montt waged a campaign of assassinations and torture against his opposition and labor leaders in Guatemala. He especially targeted Guatemala's Mayan population, and according to a UN report, Montt was responsible for the killing of more than 10,000 Guatemalans and the destruction of some 600 villages. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, March 23rd. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
Proving once again that America was not founded on religious freedom but intolerance, as of on this day on March 24th, 1661, Willie Ledra is executed, his crime being a Quaker. Also on March 24th, 1977, Argentinian author Rodolfo Walsh writes an open letter to the U.S.-backed military junta in regards to its crimes. A day later, the dictatorship assassinates him. His body and some writings will never be seen again. Also on this date in 1978, the Wampanoag claims to land in Cape Cod is dismissed by U.S. District Court in Boston because they had no tribal status in 1869. Tribal status is finally granted to them 9 years later without most of their Cape Cod lands. Also on March 24, 1988 in Israel, after a secret 7-month trial, an employee in a bomb-making factory is convicted of espionage for revealing details of the Israeli atomic weapons program to the London Sunday Times. His revelations show Israel nuclear capability to the greater extent than experts assumed, and that Israel could build up to 200 atomic bombs as well as neutron and hydrogen bombs. He got 18 years in prison, and 10 years later, in 1998, he's allowed out of solitary confinement for the first time. To this date, Israel still not signed the U.S.-touted nuclear arms agreement forced on other nations, let alone admitting they have nukes at all. More U.S. double standards. Last Anna's date in 2003, Michael Moore in Hollywood Doghouse, following last night's Academy Awards for denouncing President Bush and his war on the Iraqi people. Moore was roundly booed and jeered by the bulk of Hollywood's finest patriots. Liberal Hollywood? Yeah, right. This week in radical history for March 25th, 1812 in Russia, anarchist sympathizer Alexander Herson lives in Moscow. Journalist, political writer, novelist, influenced by revolution and the French socialism, took an active part in the revolution of 1848 in Paris and Rome, and founded the influential newspaper The Bell in London. Also March 25th, 1873, Rudolf Rocker lives. American immigrant Rudolf Rocker was an anarcho-syndicalist, theorist, organizer, and anti-fascist. He became deeply involved in the Jewish anarchist movement, author of important works including Nationalism and Culture. Part of the book he describes the emergence and development of religion. Rocker claims religion has enslaved its very creator, man, since man must submit itself to the mysterious powers over which he cannot control. He also implies that this criticism to modern-day politics. According to Nationalism and Culture, man is submitted to an all-powerful state just as he is to an all-powerful God. Thus, Rocker claims, quote, "We arrive at the very foundation of every system of rulership and recognize that all politics in its last instant religion, and that such ties hold the spirit of man in chains of dependence." Rudolf Rocker. Also on this date in 1911, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. The Triangle Shirtwaist Company, occupying the top 10 floors of a building in New York City, is consumed by fire. 147 people, mostly women and young girls, ages between 13 and 23, in working sweatshop conditions, lose their lives. Approximately 50 died as they leaped from windows of the street, and others burned or trampled to death, desperately trying to escape via stairwell's exit, illegally locked to prevent the interruption of work. Company owners are charged with 7 counts of manslaughter, but are found not guilty. A lot more happened in this day in 1916. Ishi dies. He's the last known Native American tribesperson to come out of the wilderness. After his last holdouts of his tribe, his mother and sister ran away from white settler surveyors. He would never see them again. And after a couple of years of loneliness in the California wilderness, he decides to come into a town. For a good book on the life of Ishi, read Ishi in Two Worlds.
Moloch, who entered my soul early. Moloch, in whom I am a consciousness without a body. Moloch, whom I abandon. Wake up in Moloch, light streaming out of the sky.
On this date in 1955, Moloch. U.S. Customs confiscate Moloch. 520 copies of Allen Ginsberg's Howl as they enter the U.S. It'll then be published by City Lights Publishers in San Francisco. 1 year later on this date, the government seizes more copies printed at City Lights and charge a publisher with violating obscenity laws. Let freedom ring.
I'm with you in Rockland, where you will split the heavens of Long Island and resurrect your living human Jesus from the superhuman tomb. I'm with you in Rockland, where there are 25,000 mad comrades all together, singing the final stanzas of the Internationale. I'm with you in Rockland, where we hug and kiss the United States under our bedsheets. The United States that quaffs all night and won't let us sleep. I'm with you in Rockland, where we wake up electrified out of the coma by our own souls, airplanes roaring over the roof. They've come to drop angelic bombs. The hospital illuminates itself. Imaginary walls collapse. Oh, skinny legions, run outside. Oh, starry spangled shock of mercy. The eternal war is here. Oh, victory, forget your underwear. We're free. I'm with you in Rockland. In my dreams, you walk dripping from a sea journey on the highway across America in tears to the door of my cottage in the western night.
Lastly, for March 25th, 1965, Martin Luther King Jr. leads 25,000 into Montgomery, completing Civil Rights March begun in Selma. After a week-long struggle against local police, the Civil Rights March ends triumphantly with 50,000 people demonstrating. Martin Luther King would say, "The question is not whether we'll be extremists, but what kind of extremists will we be? The nation and the world are in dire need of creative extremists."
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 26, in 1790, the United States Naturalization Law of 1790 went into effect. This act provided the first guidelines for granting U.S. citizenship. One of these guidelines specified that citizens must be free white people, excluding Native Americans, indentured servants, slaves, free African Americans, and later Asian Americans. It is legislation like this that has historically allowed groups of marginalized white people, such as Irish and Italian Americans, to reap the benefits of whiteness while simultaneously maintaining the oppression of people of color. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also March 26, 1804, first official notice to Indians from the U.S. government that all Indians must move west of the Mississippi River. Also on this date in 1910, Congress bars pulpers, anarchists, criminals, and the disease from the country, with the Immigration Act of 1907 being amended. In 1918, an anarchist draft resister, Philip Grosser, reports from Alcatraz prison that he and the opponents of the World War I were being tortured. Meanwhile, Minneapolis is the scene of the first so-called slacker raid, a dragnet of men without draft cards. During World War I, the raid seized more than 4,000 non-registered across the country. On July 15, 1919, the War Department announces that it's classified more than 337,000 American men as draft dodgers. So much for the idea of the good war.
Default.
Also on this date in 1969, John and Yoko start the 7-day bed-in against the Vietnam War. This week in radical history for March 27, 1814, Massacre at Topeka, the Horseshoe Band. General Andrew Jackson overwhelms Creek forces. To count the dead, whites cut off their noses, piling 557 of them, and skin the bodies and tan the hides for souvenirs. Also March 27, 1909, Wally Nelson, tax resister and nonviolent activist, lives, a Massachusetts farmer and conscientious objector who has refused income tax payments for over 50 years.
People, the time.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 27th, in 1969, the first National Chicano Youth Liberation Conference was held. This conference gave way to a document called El Plan Espiritual de Aztlán, which laid out the cultural, social, and political ideas and goals of the Chicano movement. The Chicano movement was born from the Mexican-American community, who organized and resisted economic slavery, political exploitation, ethnic and cultural psychological destruction, and the denial of civil and human rights. Wouldn't that make you want to fight, too? Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Say it.
Last day in 1986, the U.S. Senate approves $100 million for right-wing Nicaragua Contras while cutting domestic programs, including slashing welfare benefits. The gas oil Pentagon junta running the White House will soon scare up a new boogeyman.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 28th, in 1860, the Battle of Huareca began. This battle was part of the First Taranaki War, which was a land conflict that broke out between the indigenous Maori people and the British settlers in New Zealand. Although the British were badly defeated in this war, this victory for the Maori was only a small part of the larger New Zealand land wars, in which huge areas of land were stolen from the Maori. A treaty signed back in 1840 had guaranteed Maori tribes undisturbed possession of their lands, but the British had more military power and obviously more greed. You know their M.O. Only honor a treaty while it's convenient for you. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on March 28, 1915, dubbed the most dangerous woman in the world, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman is arrested for telling the audience how to use contraceptives. She chooses 15 days in jail over a $100 fine. Also on March 28, 1932 in Madrid, Spanish anarchists begin burning monasteries and so starts the Spanish Civil War. Also on this date in 1970 in England, time bomb found under Waterloo Station, one of many attacks in England and France during this year. Some believed attributed to the Angry Brigade or similar guerrilla anarchist groups. Lastly, on this date in 1976, organized crime, the FBI, the largest and highest U.S. police agency, discloses it burglarized the Socialist Party 92-plus times between 1960 and 1966. And it only took them 10 years to tell the truth.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 29th in 1847, Mexican forces surrendered at Veracruz, and the U.S. flag was raised. American troops then continued to march inland, eventually capturing Mexico City and ending the two-year Mexican-American War. America then established the Rio Grande River as the U.S.-Mexican border, and in the process gained control of Texas, California, Nevada, Utah, as well as parts of Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, and Wyoming. Although the Mexicans living in these territories were offered citizenship, they continued to face widespread oppression. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Two more items for March 29th, 1918, Wisconsin news. Amid growing war hysteria, 300 University of Wisconsin students packed Madison's Turner Hall to disrupt the talk by Socialist Party National Secretary Adolf Germer, who appears on behalf of U.S. Senate candidate Victor Berger. Adolf Germer, like Berger, expresses his opposition to World War I on many occasions. The UW students are armed with overripe fruit, a pot of tar, a sack of feathers. Seeing the hostile audience, Germer forsakes Berger and the anti-war movement and gives a talk on socialism instead. Immediately after Germer's talk off stage, the students, all good patriots, take over the meeting, shove him back on stage, and order him to swear an oath of allegiance to the United States. Let freedom ring. Last on this date in 1951, great U.S. injustice and state-sanctioned murder. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg are convicted of selling U.S. atomic secrets to the USSR. The case was pockmarked with glaring inconsistencies, and the chief evidence against them was the testimony of Ethel's brother, a convicted co-conspirator. But it was their fate to be tried during the height of McCarthyism. At this time, the government knew that Ethel had nothing to do with any conspiracies, but would not release this information in fear of jeopardizing their state secret wiretap ability. The government let Ethel, a U.S. citizen, die instead of revealing the secret to the defense.
This is where we are, the Zapatista National Liberation Army. The voice that arms itself to be heard, the face that hides itself to be seen, the name that hides itself to be named. The red star which calls out to humanity and the world to be heard, to be seen, to be named. Be harvested in the past. Behind our black mask, behind our Arabic voice, behind our unnameable name, behind us, who you see, behind us, we are you.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, The Palestinian Voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we will finish up our presentation of the report back by Nancy and Hubert Murray and the Reverend Mariama White Hammond. Last week we featured presentations by Nancy and Hubert Murray, and this week we feature the Reverend Mariama White Hammond, followed by a very rich discussion and answer period. This was a particularly insightful report back because of the historical perspective offered by this particular delegation. The Reverend Mariama White Hammond is an advocate for ecological and social justice, youth engagement, and spirit-filled organizing. As former director of Project Hip Hop, Highways into the Past, History, Organizing, and Power, she used the arts as a tool to raise awareness for social issues from juvenile incarceration to funding for public transportation. Reverend Mariama is very committed to engaging the faith community, and particularly the Black Church, on climate change and ecological justice issues. She presently serves as the pastor of the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Here is the Reverend Mariama White Hammond speaking at Boston University about her trip to Palestine on a delegation with Nancy and Hubert Murray, followed by a question and answer discussion.
So this was not my first trip. I went in 2015, and the reason that I'll start is that I grew up and I went to school like half mile from here at the Windsor School. It's an all-girls school. And good percentage of my school was Jewish, and we were right down the street from Temple Israel, and so I've grown up with deep relationships and connections to the Jewish community. And I remember when Yitzhak Rabin was killed, there one of the students at my school was speaking about it, and another student that I also knew called her a Zionist. The two of them got into a deep argument, and I was like, I don't know what's going on here. And so I started to learn a little bit more about Israel, about Israeli history, about the formation of the State of Israel. And then I also remember I worked a lot in hip-hop culture and working with young people around hip-hop, and remember hearing from a lot of Palestinian hip-hop artists who were describing conditions that I was familiar with, and then also conditions that were even worse than what I was used to in terms of issues with the police and issues with folks just trying to survive and live doing the basic things that human beings need to do. And so in 2015, I had the opportunity, I was a student at the School of Theology, and there was a trip called Dual Narratives, and I had been offered opportunities before that, but I really wanted to take a trip that allowed me to really look at both perspectives on how, you know, how people saw what was going on, and a real attempt to understand, what's at the foundation of this. So we read a book that's, you know, I recommend if you want to. It's called Side by Side, and it's half the book is written by Jewish history or Israeli history teachers who are all Jewish in this particular instance, and Palestinian history teachers. And when they say side by side, it's literally side by side. Like, so one page is one narrative, then the other page is the other narrative. You can't read it across. You have to just kind of read a whole chapter and then go back and read the whole other chapter. But and so it was really powerful for me because as a person who comes from an oppressed group, I have this deep question about, like, how can a group that has been so deeply oppressed also participate in the oppression of another group? And that was really the question I needed to grapple with. And I would say that first trip in 2015, I went to a lot of the places that we visited, but also some that we didn't. And I was heartbroken. I remember one particular experience, and I would say the first thing I would say is that I deeply understood the Jewish desire for a homeland. So I just want to be really clear as a person, as an oppressed person who lives in a country where you're not always sure whether the nation that you've spent your whole life in will have your back when the rubber meets the road. I understand what it is to want a place where you know that the people there will, where your life will matter. Where if all goes wrong, you have some place to go. I get it. And so the question was, a homeland, but at what price? And I remember one of the incidents that I think most I remember is, you know, I'm a knitter. I would have been knitting if I wasn't, you know, making sure that I was reviewing my notes. And I was on the bus, and I was knitting the whole time, and the color happened to be green. That was just because it was. I mean, it wasn't like a statement to knit something green. But I remember feeling like I had to hide that because we'd get to these stops, and they'd get on the bus, and it was often young people serving in, you know, their obligatory military service, but coming on with these, like, huge automatic weapons. And, you know, it's growing up in a community and running an organization in a community where guns have taken the lives of people that I love. I remember just feeling, you know, sort of, what does it mean to have your young people walking around with, like, Uzis hanging from their necks? And so I remember this young person got on, and it was Israeli color, and so everybody's, like, pulling out their passport. And as I got off, you know, I just sort of said to myself, because they were checking, because, you know, the highways are separated. This is less the case now because it's just so much less freedom of movement for Palestinians that the highways are actually less regulated than they used to be. But I had this moment when I said to myself, how can I, as a black woman, be sitting on a segregated highway built by survivors of the Holocaust? And it just felt so wrong. And so I came back, and I remember I had to write my final paper, and I, like, couldn't get myself to write it. And finally, I was like, I have to graduate. I have to finish this paper. And I literally cried my way through most of the writing. And I think it came at that point that I've struggled around nationalism as an idea, even within my own context in terms of black nationalism. And I feel like that first trip was when I came to the clear conclusion that nationalism as an ideology is bankrupt no matter what epithet you put before it. And so Zionism, which is just Jewish nationalism, is not something I can support. I just can't support it. And so that trip was, you know, really challenging. So when I got another offer, I was like, I don't know if I want to go through that again emotionally. But part of the reason I went is because this trip focused on the water crisis, which is something as a person who works on ecology has been moving in my life. Like, it just feels like the spirit keeps bringing it up in different sets of settings. I was out in Standing Rock in 2016 and really identified with the notion of water as life. I say this to my congregation all the time when we joke about it. Like, I carry in my bag almost always a water bottle and my phone. But our tendency is, if you forget your water bottle, you go, okay, you know, I'll find something somewhere else. But if you forget your phone, I don't know about you, I will go back home to get my phone. And this recognition that we as a society have come to a place where we have lost touch with what really matters. Because if I don't have my phone, it feels like I won't make it, but the truth is that I will keep breathing and I will keep living. But if I don't have water, even for 3 days, I may die. And so this question of at what price came up again on this trip. You know, the water crisis is very real, not just in Israel. The water crisis is real in Syria. The water crisis is real in southern Africa. The water crisis is real in Flint, Michigan, which is where I was visiting with a pastor friend there and preaching there last summer. And so I think we kept hearing about water, about the role that water was playing, about the lack of water and how it was causing people to have to leave. I spent some time having some conversations with Palestinian Christians, many of whom have left at this point because they do have a slightly easier time getting visas, and life has gotten so bad. And sort of the irony of seeing all these Christian pilgrims like walking around with no context for what they were seeing. And so you're like at you're at Bethlehem Square and you're taking pictures, and behind you there's a settlement, which people don't even know is a settlement. People have no context in Jerusalem. And that was really challenging for me, because even when I entered, I was like, I'm here, I'm Christian. I wore my, I was in my full, clergy gear. And they were like, oh, okay, yeah, great, so glad you're here. But, this question of the larger context of what we're facing. And for me, this crisis is not just about Israel and Palestine, but it has been demonstrated in such a powerful way. And I think the place I was most impacted was in Jericho, because I know that Jericho is one of those early places that human beings settled. The belief is that people have been in Jericho as long as 8,000 years. And the reason that they came was because water was so plentiful there. That our ancestors had known that water is the source of life long before we, had MacBooks and a lot of other things that have made us lose our sense of context. And so as we went to the spring that you would see, it literally, I Googled it to see what it had looked like before, and it just looked majestic. And it was almost impossible to believe that what I was seeing on this picture was where I was standing. And then I remember hearing about Israel's plan for the Jordan River. The plan to just move all this water to what do they call it? Redirect. It's like, how do you redirect an entire river? And I had the opportunity to swim in the Dead Sea, which is more accurately called the Dead Pond at this point. And I had this moment of what hubris allows you to believe. So for me, from a God perspective, that if God made it this way thousands, millions of years ago, you have the right to just send it in another direction because that's better for your development plans. And that hubris is not just in Israel. I deal with that hubris every day in the United States and all around the world. But it feels like they are reaching such a crisis point. For those of us who know anything about aquifers, they don't replenish quickly. It's not like if you just take them out and you get a couple good years of rain, the aquifer replenishes. It takes thousands of years for water to get to that aquifer. The idea that you could just strip it away so quickly and it's all going to work out, it just seemed absolutely ludicrous to me. And so I look at, in my life and in my work, what we as human beings need to do to turn away from the way that we're living into a way that is ultimately sustainable. And what you see in Israel and Palestine is one of the most accelerated versions of the deep connection between ecological devastation, human suffering, and just sheer human greed and folly. This literally can't work. You cannot box people more and more and more in and think they won't resist. There's something about the human spirit you cannot quench no matter how many development plans you put together. So I know we're going to have time for questions, and I know we're a little behind them. The one other story that I wanted to share was going to Hebron. which I had been to in 2015. It was probably the worst or most, you know, sort of emotionally challenging part of the trip in 2015. And then I went back and found that it was even worse the second time. When we had gone before, we were able to visit a woman whose house was, in order to sort of prevent violence and for security reasons, whole sections of Palestinian communities have been shut down so that you can create a corridor of access to the synagogue. When the synagogue is one part of what was 100% a mosque is now, you know, split. I can't remember what the percentage is of who has what, but it's split. And we met with a woman who had owned a space on that street that had been shut down, and she talked about how it used to be a great shop space because when everybody got out of prayers on Friday, they all had to walk past you, and you'd see people, and you'd sort of wave. And so she had been shut down. And when we got there, it was, you know, sort of just, boarded up or closed, and people had grates that were coming down. When we got there this past year, those same spaces had been occupied by settlers who had sort of put banners over their houses or over the shops and sort of taken over them. And then there were military people there to, like, you know, protect them for having taken this land. And where I think my heart was most deeply broken in Hebron was, so we went around, we saw the shops, we talked to people, we saw the sort of bottles of pee that were thrown over by the settlers. You can see them. They're still there. Sometimes they don't all pour onto people. So you can sort of see them hanging there. As we went deeper in, we saw more and more places that had been shut down, some places that had been opened when I had been there the last time and are no longer open at this point. And it was October, November, and I knew that we had just passed the Jewish holiday Sukkot, which I have tended to participate in because it's a holiday where you celebrate the harvest, and you celebrate nature, and you create a structure that you sit outside under branches and have dinner and are sort of in community with folks. So all these places have been shut down, and one of the ways to make sure they stayed shut down was to throw trash into the alleys, because if you put the trash there, nobody's going to come by to shop. When I looked down, I saw tons and tons of branches, the kind that I know of, you put over the school houses. And I said, when did these come? He said, like late September. And I said, oh, God, how could you celebrate a time that's about the harvest, about God's provision, and then use those branches to clutter the street of another group of folks? And so the role of religion, the role of, you know, sort of this sense that God has given me X and therefore has dispossessed you of Y. And for me, part of that is, although as a Black Christian, I was not really deeply, my particular ancestors were not deeply engaged in it, but the whole recognition that Christianity did that to Jewish people who then turned around did that to Muslim people. And sort of how this cycle of oppression in the name of God continues in such terrible ways. So those are my experiences, the things that, you know, sort of really stood out to me. And I know that we're going to engage in some dialogue, so I'll stop there and participate in the conversation. Thank you.
Yeah. So this is a Q&A portion. I'm going to ask one question, then we'll move to the audience for questions, and we'll try and keep things, you know, moving to be respectful of time. I ask that when you're thinking about questions, you make sure it's a question, because, you know, we all have a lot going on, right? And I don't care if you're an APAC plant or the most fervent Palestinian supporter. Please just make sure it's a question, okay? So with that, I actually wanted to touch on something Nancy mentioned, where you described something in one of the squares as, tasteful shows of occupation, right, with the towers. Were there other examples that you can think of with that same, in that same framework, right, where the colonization and occupation has sort of been beautified for the point of the colonists? And let's see what Mike's work in which note.
Does this one?
Yes.
You know, I was struck by that because it hadn't been there when I was there before, which was only 2 years before. And the whole of that Damascus Gate had been so transformed and sanitized. And I've never seen one of those mini towers anywhere else. Usually they just bang up one of those huge, horrendous looking, you know, you saw slides of them, giant towers. So, no, that was the only instance. But the reason it is, you know, sometime when I've been to Jerusalem, well, it's not, thanks. Sometime when I've been to Jerusalem in the past, there have been no tourists because, you know, there's been so conflict going on, no tourists. This time, there were tons of tourists. And I think now Israel is prepared for normality, the new normal. And so it's beautified that, and there were so many, what you said about the Christians walking around not having a clue, so many people taking selfies of themselves with Damascus Gate. It just wouldn't look good to have a big tower, so they shrunk it.
Hi, does this work? Yes. All right, yeah. So I'm Chance, I'm a member of the BU SJP. I really liked how the presentation talked about different forms of Palestinian resistance. So I was wondering, we're seeing more and more open violence from both the Israeli state and from settlers against Palestinians right now. There's a lot of examples of this happening. So I was wondering what more your views on Palestinian self-defense and the organization of that self-defense, if you had seen any of that in your trip or in previous trips, and your views on it more broadly, because often the Israeli state calls it Arab terrorism or violence or whatever, when really they're fighting back against, you know, settlers. So, yeah, just your thoughts on that.
Should I just say, I mean, over the years when I have had trips, I have encountered it right in front of me, various efforts to, you know, stone throwing is the most common expression of Palestinians saying, you know, we will not give up. We are here. You leave. And I've been in these demonstrations at Berlin and Narisala where there, you know, might be some stone throwing. But generally, the demonstrations that I have participated in there have been united civil society nonviolent protests. And that has a long history in Palestine, going way back to the 30s. I mean, it's nothing new. So, you know, I have seen in the Gaza Strip, I've actually seen, you know, the kind of protests, I've seen armed resistance. But we didn't see anything like that now. It was, you know, I must say, it was the last time I had been there, it was the so-called knife intifada, and people were, you know, a real act of nihilistic despair. Going out, a lot of times people were getting killed, because it was said they had a knife, but there wasn't a knife. And this is familiar when something gets planted, you know, right, after the person is just shot down. But there were cases where, you know, young people, how much can you endure these pressure cooker situations? And sometimes, you know, they would have a knife and just be holding it and get killed. But self-defense, organized self-defense, you know, they don't have it anymore in the West Bank with weapons because, among other things, the PA has got a very highly trained by America force, which is used, the Palestinian Authority, which is used to basically undergird the occupation and prevent any kind of protest, which is one of the really depressing things.
I mean, I had an opportunity to talk with someone about this specifically, and I mean, one of the things I just said is strategically, it just doesn't make sense. Like, that was their assessment, that arguing over philosophically whether it was right or not, like, if you were to do it, it would literally just give people, like, even the idea, like, that you might be doing it can be used as a justification. And so that was, you know, actually somebody else asked the question, and he was like, we could talk about it, we can argue about it philosophically, but from a strategic perspective, it just didn't make sense. And I didn't see anyone else who, like, even at least one other person that I thought, like, who had had a similar, like, assessment. So I just didn't see it anywhere that people were like, oh, that's going to be a viable way to make a difference.
Yeah, just before we move on, I just remembered, I was there during the Second Intifada on a couple of occasions when you would see somebody with a gun, right, who was maybe shooting in the direction of Yilo Settlement from Bethlehem, and then you would see these missiles fired at that person and just have them blown away. The inequality of force is so huge. And, you know, this is, it's a bit like the United States in Yemen now. Think of what we're doing in Yemen. And that is what Israel is doing. And in the Gaza Strip, you're in that tiny area and you have drones flying constantly overhead. You hear this zzzz all the time. And they are watching everything. And then they just shoot missiles down whenever they feel like it. So how can you?
Yeah.
I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things is that people see media as one of the most powerful forms of defense and one of the most powerful forms. And so if you can demonstrate that people are just literally being attacked with no weapons, no any, the idea is that actually has more ability to move people onto their side, because people, everybody we said was like, it's not going to just work out between Israel and Palestine. It will require an international movement of solidarity to make this work.
So just right there. I'm hidden behind you. just to reinforce the points that have been made. I mean, violent resistance, you're at a severe competitive disadvantage with the occupying force. So I think, you know, one of the points of BDS is that, you know, this is non-violent resistance, and it calls attention, you know, it has called attention in this country to the injustices going on. And, you know, the theme of agricultural resistance, cultural resistance that I was talking about, you know, is people just getting up every day is a form of resistance, and actually getting on with their lives is a form of resistance. And, you know, when I came back, I was speaking to somebody who didn't know much about the subject at all, and said, well, did you meet any violence? And I said, actually, no. The only violence that we came across was arguing about who was going to pay the bill in the restaurant we were living. You know, so that was it.
Maintaining the same theme, I'm just wondering how we feel about Hamas and Hezbollah, and whether we think they're freedom fighters or they're terrorists.
Well, I'm not going to speak about Hezbollah because it's not really germane. In the case of Hamas, Hamas is part of Palestinian society. It, you know, people just think Hamas, armed struggle. Hamas has got a huge social welfare program. Sarah Roy, who is a local Harvard professor, has written more than, I think she's the foremost scholar of what's happened in Gaza, that she's wrote the development of Gaza. But also she's written several books on Hamas. So, you know, I don't think, you know, Hamas is fighting for its own version of Palestinian liberation. Now, it has been very, very good at maintaining its side of bargains when it enters into a truce, it's not Hamas which breaks it, it's Israel which breaks it. You know, personally, I would rather Hamas were not in charge, just because I remember Gaza when it didn't have so much rules and regulations, you know, governing women and so forth. But, you know, people there supported it because they felt Fatah was so corrupt and not listening to them. And so they voted in 2006 in an election that Jimmy Carter was monitoring, and he said was fully fair and democratic. And that brought Hamas a legislative majority. And what Israel then did, and the United States then did, was backed a coup attempt by Fatah to defeat Hamas. It was very nasty, very violent, but very short. And what ended up happening is Hamas took charge of the government because of that attempt to overthrow the results of a democratic election. So it's a complex situation. I don't want to just say Hamas is this or Hamas is that. It is clear, though, that it is part of the Palestinian fabric.
Can I just add to that, just to say that Hamas is also not the sole leader of the March of Return? March of Return is a civilly organized march, and that action has been organized by civil society. And because the U.S. press says it's Hamas, and it's not.
No.
So, I mean, Hamas is part of it as well, but it was not organized. I just wanted to say
that. That is very clear. I mean, it was organized by people through the social media, including the person who was just here, Ahmed Abu Artima, who is not Hamas.
Hi. Oh, that's very loud. Thank you so much for the SGP for hosting us tonight, and for the three of you for this very detailed and clear presentation. With what's going on the ground in Palestine, Israel, with the new election, and how Israel allowing Kahana movement to enter the election, which Kahana, you know, holds the slogan of erasing any non-Jews in Palestine. And with the political environment in the U.S., which we witnessed by both parties, the Republicans and recently the Democrats, with in response to Ilhan Omar, we all know that the future or the upcoming year or two in Palestine is going to be like much harder on the ground. What do you think, what kind of reactions, organizations, work needs to be done from here, from the U.S., not only to react to an action or to an event or to a war on Gaza, but to really to be strategically done to confront these challenges?
So I would say one of the things that I think is actually, so this is not the way I would have wanted to come, but one of the things that I think is happening is it is actually making a lot of folks who have traditionally supported Israel ask some deep questions about whether or not they should continue supporting it. I think the reality is, and I think this I say from a spiritual perspective, if you allow things to fester, they fester, right? And so I think people have dismissed, even with Netanyahu, some of his things in the past, and now it's getting really clear how bad it is. The same way that I think, you know, I certainly would not have asked for Trump, but I think it actually is causing us to have some deep conversations that we should have been having. We could have been having 10 years ago or 20 years ago, but we are having them because he makes it so crystal clear how all of these oppressions are connected. I mean, he does it in a way that I'm not sure. I'm not sure the material conditions would have been like hugely different if a Democrat would have won. There's some things that we've been struggling with for centuries, but he makes it so clear that we have a long way to go. So I think that is that the extremeness of it is actually forcing a conversation that I'm not sure would have been had without that. On the other hand, I think that there's going to be pain and suffering. The same way that folks are struggling and suffering at the border in the United States, I think people are going to be suffering in Palestine as a result of it. And I'm not sure that folks can do much more than continue on the path of sort of nonviolent resistance. I mean, I'm not sure what they can do other than organize. I really actually believe the reckoning with this is really
a conversation with Israeli society about like how far this has come. And there are deep divisions within Israeli society. And I think it's making people ask these questions in a tougher way. Like one of the things I looked at that I thought was really powerful is when you look at early on in early Zionism, there were folks who were pro-Zionist, there were folks who were totally against Zionism, there were folks who were in the middle. But the folks who were pro kept being like recruiting people. So even if that at the beginning, if it was like 10-10 and or you know 30%, 30% and 30%, whatever, if the other group keeps bringing more people in, like your percentage is going to decline. And I think by, as I would call forcing it, like pushing the envelope so far, I think it may offer greater hope for some folks to have to face some things that were already in existence, but they're now being put in people's face in such an obvious way that they can't ignore them.
So another question.
Okay. We can talk more later.
So we'll do one more question. Just out of respect your time, I'll pop. I've done all men, so I'm going to do one woman. I'm so sorry. So I'll pop over here in 2 seconds. I wanted to let you all know there's tons of handouts and everything up here. I don't know who got what. But there's a World Water Day standout on March 22nd, which is on Beale Bridge. Pop over that. Yeah, we'll all be there. Then on 4:30
in the afternoon.
4:30 in the afternoon, so not nighttime. So there's that. There's a ton of other events, but there's also the Walk for Water on May 5th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Both the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine and the USJP have teams.
May
4th. May 4th. I'm so sorry. It's May 4th. It's also on Facebook, so pop over there too. Alright, last question.
I hope it's okay to ask this. It's a little bit off, but sort of what I thought was going to be talked about. I'm curious about the intersectionality of environmental issues with the political issues in Israel-Palestine, and if anybody feels like they would like to say a little bit about what is projected for the environment in Israel-Palestine and what effect and how does that interact with the political struggle?
So I mentioned this quickly, but I can talk more specifically. I should have pulled up the numbers, but many of the aquifers are at like a critical place, right? And there's been so some of them have been in use for years and were already depleting, which is why in the last, I think it's 5 years, there's been all this tapping, going down even lower, trying to find, you know, more remote sources of water. But the estimate I got from one person is that in the next 10 years, even if you kept the population stable at the number it is right now. And so let me just be clear. There have been water crises before, right? There have been times where people were asked to go without water, even in some instances in Israel. And now they're reaching a place where in the next 10 years, there's no way the water could sustain them, especially with the growth projections that people are putting forward. So this question becomes, where will you get water from? There is some investment or some looking at desalinization plants as an option, but desalinization is very expensive. So how that's going to be done and how it's going to be done on a level that can sustain such a large population. So the reality is, I'll say this from not just this perspective, but in general, I actually believe that water and the climate crisis is the most likely thing to lead to the collapse of some of our most problematic systems. The big question is, are we ready to imagine the alternative? Because if systems collapse, one of three things can happen. Either the, you know, folks who have already been in power adjust and figure out how to make it work, or folks who knew it wasn't working propose an alternative and people are more open to that alternative because the system is obviously collapsed. Or the collapse is so profound that we lose all semblance of order in the society. The way that they are living there and the way we are living here and the way people are living, we are pushing ourselves to the possibility that the third category is the only option. Because if everyone around is taxing their water at rates that are not sustainable, where do you even go? And so I would say the water crisis there has the possibility to be the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of that situation.
I would like to give a more hopeful response. because what, I mean, the examples that we showed, you know, so for instance, in Benin and the Omsleman farm, so, you know, starting a community-supported agriculture thing, even though it's on a fairly modest basis, you know, there are 30 families involved. What is coming out of these privations is people organizing themselves to create what they can within their own sphere of power as a resistance to the oppression, but also as a sort of, to put it in Marxist terms, prefigurative form of what they want the society to be, i.e. to be working cooperatively to create their own food supply and not be dependent on American or Israeli corporations, for instance, or NGOs for that matter. And, you know, so, and the cooperative that we went around in Canaan was a similar example, you know, farmers getting together, farmers who are living on the margins, but getting together so that they can invest cooperatively in the machinery that does all the olive pressing and the distribution and forming distribution networks. You know, these are, you know, out of this privation is coming some real creative organizing. And, you know, it's on the environmental side, on the water side, you know, there is a huge amount of pressure. But the roof gardens in we saw in Ida Camp, you know, are an example of people really tending their food, the growing of their food, and watering their food in a very disciplined manner, not this sort of mass irrigation that you see, which is so depleting of the aquifers. You know, these are all promising developments. Whether they are on a scale large enough to, you know, really redress the massive depredation that is going on is another matter. But, you know, I don't want you to be hopeless.
And I just want to say, yes, I believe it's beautiful Palestinians are finding ways to survive, but most Israelis live the way we do and have built their whole society around a form of water that's not viable.
That may just say that, in fact, water, the breakdown, which is in the Gaza Strip happening, it's becoming unlivable, it is unlivable, may be what forces Israel to change. And I'll give you one example. Because they have just been dumping raw sewage at a huge rate, they have no other way of treating it, into the Mediterranean. That has now been brought up to Ashkelon, where the biggest desalinization plant is in Israel. And it clogs the plant. And then you get these articles in the press saying, oh, poor us, maybe we have to do something about this. Likewise, because the Gaza Strip has no medicine, there's giant number of injured people because of 20,000 in this great march. And they're getting terrible, terrible infections that have that superbug quality, and they have no antibiotics to deal with it. Then you have Israel saying, oh dear, this could spread to us. We better maybe take this on board. So there could be a kind of roundabout way of all these terrible things that are going on finally forcing Israel to face what it's doing. That's optimism.
That was part two of the report back of their Palestinian trip by Nancy and Hubert Murray and Mariama White Hammond. Before we go, I want to give an update on the continuing assault by the Israeli lobby on campus groups who stand in support of Palestinian liberation, and in particular, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Campaign, BDS. Recently, there have been provocations on two campuses, Swarthmore on the East Coast and Pitzer in the West. The outside pressure on groups at Swarthmore has been so intense that it fostered the following letter of support from a number of educators and activists throughout the country. They wrote, We, the undersigned, affirm our unequivocal support for Swarthmore Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP, and their Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS, campaign at Swarthmore College. This past month, student organizers at Swarthmore have faced targeted online harassment from right-wing social media accounts for their work in solidarity with Palestine. This harassment is not happening in isolation and is no accident. Rather, it is part of a deliberate strategy we see on campuses across the country to intimidate and silence those who organize in support of Palestinian lives and dignity. While Islamophobia, white supremacy, anti-Semitism, and all forms of injustice are on the rise across the country and the world and must be vigorously challenged, we deplore these tactics that target movements for justice falsely and maliciously, accusing those organizing for justice in Palestine with anti-Semitism. Indeed, we know that this harassment happening at Swarthmore and other college campuses across the country is not really about rallying against the rising tide of anti-Semitism. In fact, this kind of unethical behavior does a disservice to the effort to challenge anti-Semitism when it does arise. We also know that this intimidation disproportionately and deliberately targets Palestinians, Black, Indigenous, and Muslim communities. Above all, we know that this intimidation will not stop the students at Swarthmore, on colleges across the country, or any of us from continuing to organize together as a movement for justice and dignity for all peoples. To the students at Swarthmore and to all students on campuses across the United States, we seek a more just world, and we've got your back. Among the long list of signers is Angela Davis, Nora Erekat, Rashid Khalidi, Stephen Saleda, Rebecca Vilcomerson, Linda Sarsour, and Rabbi Brant Rosen. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
Phoenix File. Authorized executive eyes only.
The Phoenix File. Cheviot, head of Network 23. Edison Carter, the world's top telejournalist. Murray, his hotshot producer. Theora Jones, his oh-so-clever controller. And Max Headroom, the world's first and only computer-generated person. They are all about to regret the day they conspired against Ned Grossberg. Because I have a story that will not only make us top network, it will destroy each and every one of these people. And with them, Network 23.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Labour Party Oxford economist and Irish Republican Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. More shocking evidence this week. Boeing knew the 737 MAX was a death trap, but were more concerned about their reputation than passengers' lives. It's not the first time either. Fake parts being installed on Boeings, but no action being taken to stop them. Instead, the whistleblower was sacked. Plus, as more emerges about the mass killer who shall not be named, what was going on at the same time as the mass shooting in Christchurch? What countries have issued threats against New Zealand and why? Plus, the latest David Kelly death book. from 2003, what's emerged about the reasons for the killing of a government scientist at the height of the Iraq War, WMD Lies, and how the killing was covered up. And the Rothschild anti-Semitic trope. What is a trope, and what's the facts behind the so-called wealth of the Rothschild family? Is it legitimate to single them out despite the fact that they're Jewish? Plus, from the Israeli Security Cabinet, Moshe Kalon, the secretive finance minister, what does he have to say about the Israeli state's biblical history and rights? And what about the Christian Zionists in America? What are they saying to encourage him? Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, Tuesday at noon. This week, the Easter Holidays School of Activism at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. Also, Paul Hazelden from Bristol Multifaith Forum explaining how close they are to the social ills of poverty and homelessness affecting the city, what they're doing about it, and who can and can't join them. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk right now. Help me start this week, Martin, with the shocking evidence about Boeing. This is the 737 MAX. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about this is because quite a lot has been emerging just over the last... I mean, it was happened nearly 2 weeks ago, this Ethiopian Airlines crash. It took nearly a week for the 737 MAX to be grounded, but it's now absolutely clear that Boeing pilots have been reporting this problem with the plane going into a nosedive just after takeoff and starting to nose down and then not be able to control it for months since this plane was introduced. In fact, pilots have been saying there's a serious problem with this plane. Please sort it out. They were totally ignored.
Well, as you said, Tony, what looks to be happening here is that instead of dealing with the problem, they're trying to cover it up in order to protect their reputation. And, of course, you saw this is corporate malfeasance. You know, Ralph Nader, the consumer campaigner in the US, made his name in the 70s, pointing out that GM were very, very well aware that the models of their cars were death traps because they exploded when they crashed. But instead of trying to fix it, they spent a lot of money trying to prevent it wasn't happening and to sue people who pointed it out.
But the international airline travel, that could spell disaster for Boeing. There's, I suppose, two major things here is that there are many other Boeing aircraft in the similar sort of management structure, and people will be concerned that maybe a Boeing simply isn't safe. But also there's this whole idea of autonomy. This is some sort of autonomous system that kicks in and overrides the pilot. We're living in an age now where billions and billions Musk, for example, and Tesla cars. It's not just in aviation. This whole idea is being sold to the public that we can have autonomous cars, autonomous aircraft on a massive scale, and this punctures a hole right through that.
Well, yes. I mean, I don't know enough about the technical details to say whether it's viable or not, but obviously from an economics point of view, if you're going to robotise everything, the question is, where's the working class going to get its salaries from and how are you going to make the economy work?
Well, that's another aspect to it, but it seems that they're in denial and big time about whether these robotised technologies, whether it's aircraft, trucks, trains, cars, whatever, whether it's safe.
Well, I think that's obviously the obvious thing to point to make is that once you've got chips basically making decisions, those chips are hackable. So, for example, some years ago, Hezbollah in Lebanon, when they were accused of the Hariri assassination, they said, we don't really want to do this, we've given too much away, but we're going to give you the video feed from the Israeli drone, which we think was responsible for this, because we've hacked the Israeli system. So, in other words, the Israeli military had a whole system in place, and of course, Hezbollah's job is just to hack into it, but not tell them that they've hacked into it. So you could get a situation where, you know, you fire your cruise missiles at, say, a Russian airbase, and they just hack into the system and say, go back and attack your, you know, missile fly home to where you were fired from. And, of course, that's the problem with all of these systems, is that they're hackable.
We had a whole situation with the Trident submarine missile test, didn't we, a couple of years ago by the Royal Navy in the Atlantic Ocean, where the Trident missile, even though it didn't actually have a nuclear warhead on it, thank God, went off in the opposite direction and started heading to California. Yes. Now, one does wonder if someone is having a bit of a laugh there and hacking into their Trident submarine computer system?
Well, it's a problem. It's a for military people, it's a big problem because you've got a sophisticated system which is dependent, highly dependent upon these kind of networks, and those networks are hackable. The Stuxnet virus, which was used to take down the Iranian nuclear industry, and of course the Venezuelans are accusing the Americans of taking down their electricity infrastructure using these methods last week.
So we've got a double trouble for Boeing, really. Not only is the 737 MAX 8 grounded, but they've got to convince people that when they say it's okay to fly, it really is okay to fly. And in fact, any other problem with a Boeing is going to be now put under serious question. Do you think there's anything structural different between the way, say, for example, Airbus run the A380s and A300s, or Boeing and their aircraft? They're the two big...
Well, I don't have enough technical knowledge to determine that, but clearly, again, from an economics point of view, what it shows is that aerospace in particular, it operates on such a large scale that you can't have what you might call straightforward free markets
system. Boeing,
you know, basically it's all political decisions.
Boeing
that decide
and Airbus,
what's going to happen.
Boeing and Airbus have a pretty much a monopoly. Almost every aircraft flying around is one
that's
of the
right.
other.
So that is in technical terms a duopoly. So they basically carve the world up between them, and ultimately, you know, that's to do with political struggles between the European Union and the US military industrial complex.
Anyway, I've seen very little really going into the criticism of Boeing on UK media, TV particularly, but RT America did on a show called The Rick Sanchez Show, which is run by the Russian government on US soil. And Rick Sanchez, their reporter, spoke to another reporter, he's actually a news presenter, he spoke to their reporter Rachel Blavens on what the pilots knew but Boeing ignored.
So this is a federal database where airline pilots can go and submit anonymous complaints about experiences that they have when they're flying. And we're talking about this now because the Boeing 737 MAX 8 is in the news. And it turns out that there are a number of airline pilots who have actually submitted complaints about this plane recently that are here in the United States.
And they match pretty much what we've been told about the nose of the plane that may have caused the crashes?
Exactly. So their stories are really eerie because they actually line up with some of the stories that we've seen these deadly crashes from. So let's take a look at a few of the comments that we've seen on this database. So on one of them, a pilot wrote, quote, "I looked at an engaged A autopilot as I was returning to my primary flight display. Pilot monitoring called descending, followed by an almost immediate don't sink, don't sink. I immediately disconnected autopilot and resumed climb."
Wow.
So what he's saying is that they took off, everything was fine, and then they put the plane on autopilot and all of a sudden, the nose just starts diving. And luckily,
he didn't want to go down, but the plane was doing it
on its
own.
Exactly. And it was on autopilot, so it was supposed to have been flying with no problems at all.
Wow.
And luckily, manually, they were able to fix that. But what's really scary is that there's another pilot who has the exact same story.
Wow.
So another pilot wrote in this database, and he said, quote, "The aircraft accelerated normally, and the captain engaged the A autopilot after reaching set speed. Within 2 to 3 seconds, the aircraft pitch nose down. I called descending just prior to the ground proximity warning system sounding don't sink, don't sink again. The captain immediately disconnected the autopilot and pitched into a climb." So we have another similar story. But then there's another account on this database that really calls out the airlines that use these planes and the FAA. And he's saying that the pilots who are flying these planes aren't prepared. And he said, quote, "I think it is unconscionable that a manufacturer, the FAA, and the airlines would have pilots flying an airplane without adequately training or ever providing available resources and sufficient documentation to understand the highly complex systems that differentiate this aircraft from prior models. The flight manual is inadequate and almost criminally insufficient."
Wow.
Okay, so that's Rick Sanchez's show with Rachel Blavens, the reporter. Martin is also saying that the pilots were not given any instruction on this plane as to how to use the autopilot and particularly how to keep the thing from nose pitching nose down. I mean, one can imagine that if you're trying to fly an airliner and the thing is suddenly pointing downwards, that actually there would be complete chaos in the cockpit and it would be very difficult to collect your thoughts to regain control of the plane.
Well, I understand that certain countries have grounded these planes and other countries haven't.
I think they've all been grounded now.
They've all been
finally,
grounded
after this time last week, yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously, this is very bad news for Boeing. You know, if you think about what happened with the BMW and Volkswagen being charged over diesel emissions and so on, you know, Boeing could be sued and could be bankrupted if it's serious enough, wouldn't they?
Any thoughts on this, Mark?
Well, yeah, we always go. I mean, these tragedies are awful, horrific. People died. People lost their lives. Families have lost their loved ones.
It's two plane loads, about 150 in each.
Yeah, you know, and it happened like, you know, almost week after week, with the end of last year and then a couple of, you know, last week. And we see continually, and the total kind of sense of impunity, this the leadership, the people who run these companies all around the world, whether it's the Lloyds thing we talked about before, or whether it's Boeing now, or a million other things we could come up with, or the fact that extremism goes on, whether it be Islamic extremism, Jewish, Israeli extremism, white extremism, whatever it is, they're all being fed this kind of message that it's okay to go out there and treat the world as you want. The human beings are worthless, that, you know, we just live the life. I heard Noam Chomsky talking about Rex Tillerson when he was the minister, what do they call it in America?
Yeah. I think he was defense.
Secretary of State. Yeah. You know, this is a guy who ran Exxon Oil for 30-odd years. Every year, this guy got an internal report on the state of climate change and the impact of his industry on climate change, of pulling this raw materials out of the earth and the way they're using it. And Noam Chomsky says, here I am, a celebrated linguist who's considered one of the finest kind of linguist philosophers of the 20th century, and I cannot come up with a word which describes how evil these people are. It's beyond, it's not Hitler and Mussolini anymore, Stalin. We're talking a whole different league. They don't care about their children, they don't care about their grandchildren, and if they don't care about their own families, why would they possibly care about you and me? And we are seeing it across the board. These people think they're going to live forever. They think that we're not important. They think they own the planet. They live on the planet as though they're aliens from another place. And this is something that needs to be...
Martin, isn't there some sort of reason for people like this being propelled into these positions of power?
Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? I mean, those who desire power and wealth and the things of this world, if you like, they make sure that they are propelled up that greasy pole, don't
is
they?
Is it like a drug?
You know, not everybody wants like... to be a musician or a critic. You know, the people who really want to go out there and do that stuff, they're the people that put themselves forward, aren't they?
Like a drug?
Well, it is, obviously. I mean, all power corrupts, Lord Acton, all power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely.
What's that wonderful story, sci-fi story, which starts off, you know, we're 20,000 years in the future and the galaxy is settled all over and there's a president elected once every 7 years, except they're not elected. You know, a massive supercomputer goes through during the 7 years that the president is in power. A supercomputer goes through and picks out the most... the person who will do the job best as the next president of the galaxy. And there's only one law attached to this thing, is the person cannot refuse, because anybody who suits the job knows that it's an impossible job and doesn't want it, you know. So anybody who agrees to the job is the last person you want. Anybody who says they can run a country, fire their ass.
Okay,
you know?
Well, going back to Boeing, in October 2017, there are a whole bunch of stories around the world about a similar sort of thing to this, where fake paperwork and poor parts the Boeing genuine parts were replaced by these fake parts. Boeing were told about it by a whistleblower and promptly sacked the whistleblower. So this isn't the first time this sort of thing has happened in one of these massive corporations, and I'm no doubt it will be the last. But it just seems a little bit embarrassing to me that our press is really not, and our criminal justice system is not getting to the bottom of this, because if mistakes like this have been made, if people are just simply not doing their job in making sure airliners are safe to travel in when they perfectly easily could do, then surely people should be going to jail.
Well, the people, I just want to say one thing. The people who own Boeing, they don't fly in Boeings. They fly in Learjets, so they don't have to worry about anything.
Yes, a Gulfstream and things like that. Absolutely right, Mark. Okay, anyway, so let's just have a look now at the repercussions from the... it literally just happened, hadn't it, as we came on air last week, Martin, over in Christchurch. 100 dead and injured, so it's about, is it 50, just over 50 now have died, and another 50 were hospitalised, seriously injured. What do you make of the New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern's her reaction? What she's saying is that she doesn't want this guy named, which is an interesting angle on it all, isn't it? Because that was partly what he wanted. He wanted to be notorious around the world, and that's why I haven't named him today.
To be honest,
and funnily enough, I gave him the wrong name last week, so he's never been named on this show.
Well, I must admit, I mean, she can say as a sort of moral statement by her that I'm not going to name him in the Parliament and all the rest of it. But, of course, there's going to have to be a court case, and then the court case, we're going to have to find out what actually happened. Because, of course, the question with this, as with all such attacks, is did he act alone? And, of course, there was the original reports were that there was more than one shooter and that the bombs, that there were bombs in vehicles.
Have you got
and
any
then suddenly that was all clear.
Have you got any evidence that there was another shooter? Surely it was.
Well, no, the police at the time, the first things that came, as you know when these incidents happen, Tony, stuff comes out in the first few minutes, which then gets airbrushed out, and then you get an agreed narrative about what happened. And we all think we know what happened. I mean, to be honest with you, if something like this happens, it would take the police quite a while to work out the series of events and all the rest of it. And it turned out, for example, that there was that the police who apprehended him were not the local police. They were a firearms unit which just happened to be doing something nearby. Now, I'm not saying we don't know enough to say anything firmly about this one way or the other. But given, you know, as you know, over many years, we've looked into these incidents thoroughly, not just this one, but previous ones, and we know that intelligence services around the world do engage in terrorism. In fact, most terrorism has the fingerprints of intelligence services all over it, and not, you know, different intelligence services, not necessarily the same ones. And lone gunmen like Oswald killing John F. Kennedy, or Sirhan supposedly killing Robert Kennedy, and you know, James Earl Ray supposedly killing Martin Luther King, although a jury in the US, North Carolina, has already concluded that he didn't, and somebody else was involved. We're suspicious about all these incidents, as we should be.
Those are kind of political terrorist acts, you know. I'm not quite sure what would be achieved. And you may be absolutely right. You know, I'm always a bit wary of conspiracy theories, because I think people who are willing to take part in a conspiracy can't keep their mouths shut, most probably, because they'll most probably be a bit too kind of...
Well, that's why a lot of people end up being killed. Like, yeah, they don't get to try.
It's hard to keep it quiet, if you know what I mean. But I'm definitely not saying no, you know, absolutely. And I'm sure there is all sorts of awful stuff going on.
Well, nobody has a grudge against New Zealand.
And that's what I'm saying. What would be the reason I'm trying to...
We'll come to that now, okay?
Yeah, that's what I'm interested in.
We'll come to that now. I'm sure Tony will
so we've got a couple of incidents of bomb threats in New Zealand. Now, this is an Israeli autistic man who's been sentenced to 10 years in jail for making thousands of bomb threats in New Zealand and other countries during 2016 and 2017. But more seriously, the Israeli Prime Minister in December 2016 told New Zealand's foreign minister that support for a UN resolution condemning Israeli settlement building in the occupied territories would be viewed as a declaration of war, according to reports in the Israeli media. The Israeli PM has made these threats, so nobody apparently is threatening New Zealand apart from Israel. Well, why might that be, Martin?
Well, in Christchurch, during the earthquake some years ago, local police arrested Israeli intelligence agents who were trying to steal the identities of victims so that they could use that for, you know, creating New Zealand passports, which their agents could then use around the world. And that's at the time the Israeli government were fed up, and they withdrew their ambassador to Israel, and the Israelis were not very... Israel and New Zealand had a very, very frosty relationship.
Let's go over a little more detail there, because the body
was found in Christchurch of someone that turned out to be an Israeli agent with stolen passports on.
Yeah.
And there were other people who were trying to get that body, and they were, rather than being arrested, they were whisked off to the airport immediately by the Israeli ambassador to New Zealand.
Yeah.
So he actually got personally involved, managed to get these people together, and got them out of the country very quickly, whereas actually the New Zealand police wanted to arrest them and question them.
Yeah. Now, when incidents like this happen, Tony, we've got to, you know, whether Charlie Hebdo or...
What's the New Zealand passport?
No, the New Zealand, New Zealand has got a fantastic reputation in the world as being a sort of fair country with no enemies. And if you're a Mossad, you want those passports so you can go around the world pretending to be who you're not. And that's not the only case of Israeli agents trying to steal New Zealand passports. And the New Zealanders have caught them out a couple of times and are pretty fed up with it, because obviously
also they like Canadian passports as well, because of the same, for the same reasons that, you
which
know,
which passport?
Canadians,
yeah,
Canadian,
exactly.
Passport, the same reasons. Good healthy passport gets you into any country.
That's
kind
right.
Of,
I mean, the guys that carried out the assassination on the Hamas guy in Qatar or whatever it was, in Dubai, I mean, they were all using passports, you know, false passports basically. And it's very important if you're going to carry out assassinations and so on that you've got false identities to use.
They're not false. What makes them
real identities?
They're not forgeries, they're real identities, and that's what makes them so powerful.
Yeah. That's the idea, because okay, penny's dropping now. So that's why they were at the earthquake, because these were real people.
Yes.
And they could use those identities, just pretend that they hadn't.
It's like a Hollywood movie, you know, somebody who, like, takes the name off a grave.
One of the other things they did in New Zealand is they found people who were disabled and unlikely ever to travel, you know, people who lived in wheelchairs and were housebound, and they applied for passports in their name. Yeah, pretending to be those people, yeah, and they were caught again by the New Zealand police. And, you know, that's the way the world is, and therefore the motive to become... false flag terrorism isn't just conspiracy theory. I'm afraid it's been going on for a long time. The Gladio networks in Western Europe, which we've talked about quite a lot on this show, Fernando Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book coming out in 2012 called La Repubblica di Stragi Impuni, and he was the head of the Italian Supreme Court, pointing the finger firmly at NATO intelligence services for the bombing of Bologna, the assassination of Prime Minister Aldo Moro, the bombing of Piazza Fontana in 1969. People in educated people in Italy know very well that NATO intelligence services are terrorists, and they have been for a long time.
I mean, there's so many examples, isn't there, of America, you know, going into South America, and Chile is one example.
Yeah.
Well,
that's the more overt stuff, if you like. Yeah. But they do lots of trickery, and they've got a huge infrastructure for doing it, and they've been caught out, and people ought to realise that this is what's going on. And of course, I work quite regularly for Russia Today, as you know, and I can tell you right now, the Russian general staff are right up on top of all of this. They know exactly what's going on.
So you're having private meetings with the Russian?
No, I don't. I just work as a journalist for them. But I'm just pointing out.
That's not the Russian general staff. Russia Today editors and journalists.
That's indeed. But I'm pointing out that if you look at the statements by the Russians, General Ivashov, who was in command of the Russian armed forces on 9/11, is out there on the record saying we know what happened there. That was carried out by the US
security
forces.
One thing that is not deniable in any way is the fact that at the same time as this attack in Christchurch, Israel was striking 100 targets in Gaza in response to rockets fired at Tel Aviv. The Israeli army assessed that militants mistakenly fired rockets at Tel Aviv during maintenance work.
Two rockets.
Yep, and in exchange, 100 went the other way. Can you just tell us what you make of that sort of thing? I mean, I can remember there was an attack, it was in Georgia, wasn't it? Actually, no, South Ossetia, at the same time as against the Russians, at the same time as the opening ceremony of the Chinese Olympics. Mm. So when there's a massive event that's going on, everyone's watching, sometimes something else is going on behind the scenes. And that was the case in Christchurch. At the same time, there was a 100-target rocket attack on Gaza, which we heard virtually nothing about.
Well, I mean, I don't think you can. I mean, there may be a linkage there, but I mean, the real point is that the message is being sent by the gangster elite in Israel is you don't mess. You know, we will put concrete boots on you if you cross us. And I think the New Zealand intelligence services may also have been implicated in some of this. You know, it's not clear that they are entirely on the right side. Anyway, they're part of the Five Eyes setup. Jacinda Ardern is obviously a decent person, but she doesn't necessarily control her own intelligence services.
Before we leave Gaza, what do you make of what's happening there, Mark?
That's a big question. Can you be more specific?
Well, some call it a place where there are literally tens of thousands of terrorists. Others say it's more like a concentration camp.
No. Everywhere there are terrorists. You know, I mean, they're just up. Terrorists just went and massacred a bunch of people in Christchurch, and we got terrorists all over the place. And there are going to be people who will be willing to use violence in Israel, in Gaza, in Lebanon, and London, and in Bristol. Okay, so that's things. But Gaza is undoubtedly on the edge of being a concentration camp. It has been under siege for 12 years. It is, according to the UN reports and anybody who's been there and seen it, uninhabitable. In 2 years, the water will be undrinkable because of the sewage that's flowing into the system. So in a year and a half, 2 years, a mother will have to decide whether to kill her child quickly or slowly. The Israelis are turning on and off the electricity and the water supply at will, whenever they feel like it. There are 60-70% unemployment. There is. I have many friends in Gaza who I'm in contact with. They are past a point now they talk about suicide, but not suicide bombing, just suicide in general, because they see no purpose in life anymore. Gaza is a scar on the face of this earth, and all governments around the world are guilty of allowing it to carry on under our very noses. We have the criminal court in The Hague should be out doing much more. The United Nations, they release reports, so every country just throws it out the window and says we're not interested. Why? Because the security system that's, you know, tracked down Khashoggi from Saudi Arabia was built by Israel, and the security systems for monitoring people in the UK and in America are built by Israel. They want these toys, and they don't care. And if it's convenient, you know, and it's kind of a white imperialist male piece of madness going on. Instead of dealing with the world and the problems that are coming, they're kind of pulling us back to the 19th and 20th century.
But it's not just Israelis doing this.
Not just Israelis.
I noticed there's a story in The Guardian this week, UK, US and Israel surveillance obsession. So this is a fantastic amount of spyware being sold by the Brits. Human rights fury as UK licenses £75 million of spyware exports. The abuse of technology by autocratic regimes is being ignored, say campaigners.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely, it takes two to tango. Israel can only do what it does with impunity in Gaza because of the rest of the world, and specifically governments in the West or Western-style governments, allow them to get away with it. Everybody's, you know, in there trying to make a buck and use their new technology, and spyware is cool stuff to make and easy to make. It's just simple technology that armies, we have to remember that armies have been receiving budgets to develop computer technology from the 70s and the 60s and the 50s. They are way ahead of the curve. A lot of the people come out of the armies. It's very common in Israel. It's going to be common in the UK, common in America. They leave the armies with masses of knowledge. They're 25 years old. You know, they're picked up by high-tech companies. Their brain power is put to use, and people go out there and exploit the situation.
But we're sleepwalking into some kind of 1984 world.
Well, we're sleepwalking into a world where we're dealing with stuff which is irrelevant, because if we don't deal with climate change, there's going to be nothing here at all anyway in another 30 years. So what does it matter?
Okay, so let's have a look now at the Rothschild family. I'm really prompted to do this by a video by Momentum. And in fact, we had Jackie Walker on this programme a few weeks ago, who was removed as the deputy head of Momentum with allegations of anti-Semitism. But Momentum is now very much promoting things which are explaining, apparently, anti-Semitic tropes. Now, I'll just ask both of you, you first, Martin, explain, what is an anti-Semitic trope?
Well, a trope just means a figure of speech, as it were. And I suppose what's meant by this is that if we say that the Rothschilds are an extremely wealthy family who've had their fingers in many pies for many, many years, that's seen as anti-Semitic. But as far as I'm concerned, that's just anti-Rothschild. I mean, I'm not very keen on J.P. Morgan either. I don't like Rupert Murdoch. I don't care really what people's religious beliefs are, but if they're criminals, they're criminals. And if they're badly behaved, they're badly behaved, aren't they?
It's really interesting. It goes back to... I agree with you, first of all, Martin, 100%. Okay, but it's really interesting where it comes from and why this association. And we've had this conversation. We touched on it before, Tony. The in Europe in the Middle Ages and onwards into the Renaissance and up into the Industrial Revolution, until there was kind of civil and equal rights for Jews and many other ethnic groups who were considered second-class citizens in Europe up until, the 18th century, the Jews in Europe fundamentally were only allowed to engage in trade and money-type stuff. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that they wanted to. They weren't allowed to own land. They weren't allowed to be aristocrats. They weren't allowed to be in politics. So they were kind of shoveled into this very small bandwidth of what they were allowed to do. Okay, so when you focus all your energy, add to that within Jewish life, all the kids learn to read and write, and they're going to have 10, 12 kids. You're going to have 3 or 4 going to be really bright and able to use it, and you're going to have a higher percentage of people who can go out and do stuff because they're literate compared to the neighbors, most of whom aren't literate. So you have this weird circumstance come about where the Jews of Europe were only allowed to basically engage in money. That's why The Merchant of Venice was written, of course, and that's the association with Sherlock and what have you, and he's a Jew and all of that. And out of that, we got these families and the Rothschilds, and they're not the only family. The Rothschilds are most famous, who were good in that field, and they became really good at banking and trading. They also had a kind of, I kind of call it like a Jewish internet. They weren't, they were moving between cities and they went into their little Jewish communities and they were supported and looked after so they could move and travel. And that's why the diamond business is so powerful amongst the Jews. They could travel safely between their small protected communities. But what stuck to that was the stigma of the Sherlock and this whole Jewish thing, which was Shylock. This stigma of this Jewish and money thing being connected, and that's what's hanging over when we see the Rothschilds. So, of course, they should be treated as people who are rich, and either we agree with what they do or don't agree with what we do. We do need to recognize that stuff has stuck to them because of a history of persecution over a thousand odd years.
One of the key things in this Momentum video is denying that the Rothschild family in London, with Nathan Rothschild being the first banker who was sent over here in the 1700s, late 1800s, that he made his money from the Battle of Waterloo. And I looked into this because I'd seen some evidence on both sides. If you go online, you'll find evidence on both sides. But it seems pretty clear to me that it was tested in court back in the early part of the 1900s, and the Rothschild family brought a court case against someone who was publishing a book which was telling this story, and lost, and got told to pay all the compensation for it.
But anyway, who lost?
The Rothschilds lost.
Okay.
So anyway, so let's have a little listen now to this story about the Rothschilds making their money out of the Battle of Waterloo, as told by Bill Still in his film The Money Masters.
This is the Waterloo battlefield about 200 miles northeast of Paris in what today is Belgium. Here Napoleon suffered his final defeat, but not before thousands of French and Englishmen gave their lives on a steamy summer day in July of 1815.
Right over there, on June 18, 1815, 74,000 French troops met 67,000 troops from Britain and other European nations. The outcome was certainly in doubt. In fact, had Napoleon attacked a few hours earlier, he would probably have won the battle. But no matter who won or lost, back in London, Nathan Rothschild planned to use the opportunity to try to seize control over the British stock and bond market, and possibly even the Bank of England. Rothschild stationed a trusted agent, a man named Rothworth, on the north side of the battlefield, closer to the English Channel.
Once the battle had been decided, Rothworth took off for the Channel.
He delivered the news to Nathan Rothschild a full 24 hours before Wellington's own courier. Rothschild hurried to the stock market and took up his usual position in front of an ancient pillar. All eyes were on him. The Rothschilds had a legendary communications network. If Wellington had been defeated and Napoleon was loose on the continent again, Britain's financial situation would become grave indeed. Rothschild looked saddened. He stood there motionless, eyes downcast. Then suddenly he began selling. Other nervous investors saw that Rothschild was selling. It could only mean one thing. Napoleon must have won, Wellington must have lost. The market plummeted. Soon everyone was selling their consols, their British government bonds, and prices dropped sharply. But then Rothschild started secretly buying up the consols through his agents for only a fraction of their worth hours before. Myths, legends, you say? 100 years later, the New York Times ran a story which said that Nathan's grandson had attempted to secure a court order to suppress a book with this stock market story in it. The Rothschild family claimed the story was untrue and libelous, but the court denied the Rothschilds' request and ordered the family to pay all court costs.
Well, there's the story, and this is the version of it that you get in this recent Momentum video, which has been produced by Michael Walker.
If you, like me, spend a lot of time online, you'll probably have come across a lot of claims about the Rothschilds. That they have amassed 80% of the world's wealth, that they control every central bank in the world other than Russia's, and that they're responsible for instigating wars and controlling governments. The problem is, none of this is actually true. The Rothschilds were a wealthy banking family in the 19th century, but that was a long time ago. And now their descendants are scattered across the world with little in common other than a surname. Some of these people are rich, but nowhere near the levels of wealth of the richest people in the world today. Benjamin de Rothschild, a French businessman, has a net worth of $1.7 billion. But he's the only Rothschild in the Forbes rich list at number 1,121. And the world's richest man, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, is worth 65 times that. The closest thing to any Rothschild family business today is the Rothschilds Group Investment Banking Company. They have annual profits of $70 million. But the world's largest company, Walmart, makes more than $120 billion annually. That's almost 2,000 times as much. And central banks like the Bank of England are, of course, state institutions and have nothing to do with any Rothschilds. But why does this matter? Whether Benjamin de Rothschild is at number one in the world or at number 1,001, he can probably look after himself, right? It matters because this is a historic anti-Semitic trope that blames the world's problems not on capitalism or structural inequalities, but on conspiracies by secretive Jews. This is one of the peculiar aspects of anti-Semitism that some of us on the left are not so instinctively used to. Whereas many racisms punch down, calling other peoples inferior, anti-Semitism casts Jews as powerful overlords, conspiring and manipulating behind the scenes.
You want to bring down the cultural fabric of America, because you're a Jew.
The Rothschilds family were Jewish and have featured in these anti-Semitic conspiracies since the 19th century, when Nathan Meyer Rothschild faced false accusations of profiteering from the Napoleonic Wars. Today, the trope of the conspiratorial Jew is often applied to George Soros, the Hungarian Jewish Holocaust survivor and liberal investor, cast by right-wingers as the Jew behind the scenes manipulating world events and even falsely accused of being a Nazi collaborator himself.
Who's the puppet master?
The term Zionist is used, not as part of a discussion about the situation in Israel and Palestine, or about the history of Zionism as an idea and a movement, but simply as code for Jews who control things, from the Zionist occupation government theory of fascists like Nick Griffin.
There is a disproportionate number of Jews involved in all levels of the mass media.
To the Rothschild Zionists of David Icke, and claims that Zionists control Western finance, politics, and media. And that's how you end up with memes like this, with a Rothschild, Soros, and others depicted as globalists, Zionists, or something else, all people who just happen to be Jewish. And if you find this video useful, please send it to friends who aren't aware of these tropes. Let's make clear that Jews are always welcome in the labour movement, and anti-Semitism isn't.
I suppose I should ask you, first of all, Mark, what you make of that. We're all told, I mean, really he's presenting two apparent anti-Semitic tropes there, one about the Rothschilds, and the other one, which I was quite surprised to hear, is that the Zionist trope, which is apparently the word is code for Jews who control things.
Oh, well, the word Zionist has been twisted and turned around so much over the last 100 years. That it's really hard, you know, to know really what it represents. For many people, Zionist and Jew goes hand in hand. You know, I'm basically an anti-Zionist, but I'm a Jew, and I'm an Israeli. But so it's become a code word amongst kind of extremist organizations to mean Jew. As far as I don't really know how to move forward from there, if that makes sense.
Okay, so what about the? I mean, for example, saying that this is a. I mean, I've just told the story. I mean, maybe. I mean, people might accuse me of being anti-Semitic for just telling that story. He says that this thing about making money out of the Napoleonic Wars is a false accusation, and yet, if you look in the New York Times, I mean, I've just done a bit of research on it. Apparently, in the April 1, 1915 edition, reported that Baron Nathan Mayer Rothschild had attempted to secure a court order to suppress a book written by Ignatius Baller entitled The Romance of the Rothschilds on the grounds the Waterloo story about his grandfather was untrue and libelous. The court ruled the story was true, dismissed the suit, and ordered Rothschild to pay all the court fees.
Yeah, but
another thing he's talking about in there is, oh, they're not on the rich list. But we know from Kevin Cahill, who sits in this studio from time to time, about once a month at the moment, that there's a lot of people who are super rich and spend quite a lot of time making sure they're not on the rich list, including the Queen, who threatened to sue the Sunday Times unless she was removed from the rich list, saying that the Crown Estates were not part of her property, even though she can buy and sell land on the Crown Estates at any time she wants, that there are ways of actually making the rich list not include, and there are also ways of hiding wealth. It's very easy to hide your wealth.
That's got nothing to do with being Jewish, though.
No, but what I'm saying,
that whole point, this whole connection with the Jewish thing is a load of rubbish. It's like, you know, some people happen to be Jewish. Some people, I mean, the richest guy in the world, Croesus, was a West African black guy. You know, he spread out so much gold, he gave away so much gold when he went on the Hajj to Mecca that the price of gold was devalued for about 100 years. You know, the whole thing is this connecting up, and we even the conversation is childish and stupid, because what we're doing is, I mean, I respect you and the need to bring it out, but what we're doing is we're perpetuating this myth that people can buy into. People will believe what they want to believe. It's really simple. People want to think, you know, the Jews control the world. We could lay it out for them however we want. They're always going to believe that because it's convenient for them. You know, people want to believe that Barack Obama shouldn't be president of the United States because he wasn't born in America. You know, they say whatever, including the president.
So Martin, this is genuinely associated with people with Nazi ideas too, isn't it?
Well, look, I mean, I think that it's pretty clear that anti-Semitism is completely unacceptable. But naming the Rothschilds, they are one of the powerful families that rules the world, but they're not the only one, as has just been pointed out. And of course, there's plenty of poor Jews. That's what's good about them. And you know, the people who worked in the textile industry.
You're looking at one right now, by the way.
But by the way, you know, the old Jews are rich is absurd, you know.
So what I'd like to do now is I did talk to the jazz musician Gilad Atzmon about this, and this is what he had to say after having watched this Momentum video.
My name is Gilad Atzmon. I'm a musician and a writer. I write about Jewish identity politics, and I play jazz in between. My issue with this Momentum's conspiracy video is it is there to set boundaries of correctness of what we are allowed to talk about and what is it that we should never mention. Now, there may be an argument that the Rothschilds are not as influential as they used to be. However, in the film, we learned that we shouldn't talk about the Rothschilds, and we should talk about George Soros. And it is quite surprising because according to our basic understanding of working class politics and the left operation, we are supposed to be against bankers and capitalists, but somehow certain kind of capitalists we are not allowed to mention. What do those two capitalists have in common? They're Jews. So I assume that we are allowed to be critical of bankers and capitalists unless they are Jews, which means that in the eyes of Momentum or Labour, if I'm saying Labour because Corbyn was very happy to endorse this film, Jewish bankers are in a privileged position in British Labour in 2019.
There were a lot of conspiracy theories to do with the Rothschilds that saying that they are controlling Europe, if not United States as well, through their wealth. But those, surely there has to be an end to those sorts of conspiracy theories.
Okay, I'm not an expert on financial affairs, and I cannot comment on questions whether these are conspiracies or not, what is the influence of the Rothschild in the Federal Reserve and so on and so on. But I can tell you something else. I'm working on Jewish history, I'm working on Jewish identity politics, and I recently, a year ago, and it was in 2017, it's probably a year and a half ago, we had all those celebrations around the Balfour Declaration. And within the context of the celebration of the Balfour Declaration, 100 years for the Balfour Declaration, I saw an interview with an elder Rothschild. They were influential enough in the eyes of the Jewish community here and the Zionist Federation. They were influential enough to be at the core of this story. And why? Because apparently it was Rothschild who was the engineer, the guy who orchestrated this Balfour Declaration. So the attempt of Momentum to wipe the Rothschild out of the history books is slightly pathetic.
Well, one of the things they say is that Rothschild is really a code for anti-Semitism, for having a go at all now, Jews.
Now, this is something that they have to substantiate. But there is something, when I saw the video, there is something that I have to tell you and your listeners don't know, I assume. And this is something that I grew up, it's not due to my scholarship, I just grew up in Israel as an Israeli secular Jew. The song, If I Were a Rich Man, do you know the song? If I Were a Rich Man. Yeah, it's a song that a lot of people of our generation know. This song, originally, in Hebrew and in Yiddish, you can find if you look, If I Were a Rothschild, you will find the song. This song originally was written as If I Were a Rothschild. If I Were a Rothschild, or in Hebrew, Lu Haiti Rothschild, 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 yeah? Which means, and this is something that is very crucial, that within the context of Jewish culture, and this is something that maybe doesn't apply anymore, to become a Rothschild or to be a Rothschild, it was an aspiration for all Jews, and definitely Jews in the East, in the Pale area. And this is exactly the story of Fiddler on the Roof.
Well, that's an interesting little take on the Jewish history, isn't
it? But he's
it?
Talking also about Walter Rothschild there, back in 1917. He was the architect of the Balfour Declaration.
Yeah, I think what you've got to recognise is that people like Sheldon Adelson, for example, in the US, who owns masses of casinos in Macau and Las Vegas and so on, biggest funder of US politics, he's very firmly pro-Israel. And, you know, these are very... George Soros, less so. I mean, I think the Israeli government rather dislike his interventions because he tends to be more, liberal-minded in his politics.
Okay.
And I think the fact is that Jews have got all very varied politics, but many wealthy Jews are very strongly supportive of the State of Israel and its reactionary policies.
I think we're going to have to leave some of the stuff till next week. But I think I'll finish with this. I mean, this whole business of the Christian Zionists in the United States, I think, is so important to understand what is being said in order to sort of boost the whole sort of fueling of the whole Zionist thing in the US. And when you start to unpick it, it gets pretty frightening. So we're going to have a listen now. And this is not something, certainly not something that this show endorses in any way. But it's a Christian Zionist pastor called John MacArthur. And this is what he says about the whole Islam, he's talking about here the Islamic prophecies of the end of the world and the Christian prophecies of the end of the world. So we'll have a minute or so just to have a listen to that at the very end, or to discuss what we're about to hear, which is one of the Christian Zionist bits of philosophy that they've taken out of the Bible, which I can tell you I certainly do not, as a Christian, agree with at all.
In Islamic eschatology, there are three great signs of the end of history. Three great signs. There are some lesser signs, or some minor signs, and some major signs. In their eschatology, again, quoting their sources exclusively, there are three great signs of the end of history. And each of them is a man. The first man that will come in the end of history is the Mahdi. M-A-H-D-I. Sometimes he's called the 12th Imam. Every time Ahmadinejad over in Iran gives a speech, he says, glory to the Mahdi, glory to the 12th Imam. Every time. He's waiting for the coming of the Mahdi. What is he coming to do? He's coming, listen carefully, to slaughter all who will not worship Allah, convert to Islam. They are identified in their writings as pigs and dogs, and to establish the everlasting world-dominating kingdom of Islam. That's what he will do. The Mahdi, or the 12th Imam, that means the guided one, is the long-awaited savior. He is the establisher of the final caliphate. The world must follow him as he takes over, or he will destroy all enemies of Islam. He will come and he will carry on holy war, and either you convert or you're killed by the Mahdi. He will have an army. His army will be a massive army, and his army will go from nation to nation to punish the unbelievers. The holy writings of Islam say that this army will carry black flags. And on those black flags, there will be one word, and that one word will be the word punishment. By the way, the Iranian army today carries black flags. They want to be ready for the coming of the Mahdi. He will lead the army of black flags first to Israel, slaughter all the Jews, and then he will establish his rule in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount. That's what their literature says.
Now, that's he's a Christian Zionist pastor. His name is John MacArthur. I wonder I'll ask you first, Mark, what you make of that, because this is the kind of stuff. I mean, he's basically saying, look, Islam is a killer faith. They're black flags, and they are hell-bent on destroying Israel.
Wasn't there a period of time in history when some guys called the Crusaders went roaring across the world in the name of God and, you know, slaughtering anything in their path and wanting to take over Jerusalem? So it's a pretty old story, just reinvented. Most of this stuff, I don't know enough about Islam. I'm going to keep it really short. I've read bits and pieces, but 99% of the stuff that we get spouted at us, be it from Christianity, from Judaism, and from the monotheistic religions, is interpretations and commentary. And that's what they're reading from. People can make up whatever they want, twist anything. If you want to buy into it, buy into it. Mm. It's about buying into hate.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Martin. That's just his interpretation of the Quran. I'm sure he's not ever been exposed to any real criticism.
Well, I mean, the obvious point to make is that the black flags are carried by Wahhabis, who are strict Sunnis, and the 12th Imam is basically an idea of the Shia, and the Shia and the Sunnis don't agree about this, so he's conflated the two things together as if they're the same, when in actual fact it's the Iranians who've been fighting in Syria against the Wahhabis, who are supported by Saudi Arabia, who are Israel's allies. Isn't that amazing?
But, I mean, this is a really poisonous kind of conflation, isn't it? A poisonous kind of...
It's basically ignorance.
Yeah, but it's
any,
not.
Any Muslim would know immediately that that's just demonstrating complete ignorance of Islam.
But the poison is there. These people are now, including Trump, has just recognised the Golan Heights for Israel, for example.
Well, Mike Pence, the vice president, who will take over if Trump is assassinated, is a fundamentalist Christian Zionist. There you go.
Okay, well, I'll put a link up to our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. You'll find this show's podcasts and story links at thisweek.org.uk, and I'll put a link up to that last interview too. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan. This week, we speak with Ahmad Abu Ertema, a Gaza-based journalist and author, and one of the organizers of the Gaza's Great March of Return, as well as historian Jihad Abu Salim, who is also staff member of the American Service Friends Committee about the Great March, and the impacts of Israel's decade-long blockade of the Gaza Strip. Later in the program, Dr. Persis Karim, the director of the Center for Iranian Diaspora Studies at San Francisco State University, joins us to talk about the center's upcoming two-day conference marking the 40th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution. Stay with us. Last year, on March 30th, Palestinians launched the Great March of Return to demand an end to the decade-long and inhumane and illegal Israel's blockade of the Gaza Strip and the return of Palestinian refugees to their homes. In the past year, more than 250 unarmed Palestinians have been killed in the weekly protests, and tens of thousands have been injured and maimed by Israeli occupation forces. To mark its first anniversary on March 30th, Palestinians are calling for another mass mobilization at the border with Israel. Vomino producer Mira Nabulsi spoke with Ahmad Abu Ertema, a Gaza-based journalist and author, and one of the main organizers of the Gaza's Great March of Return, as well as Jihad Abu Salim, staff member of the American Friends Service Committee in Chicago, about the genesis of the mass mobilization in Gaza and the devastating consequences of the Israeli-imposed siege on Palestinians who live there.
I wanted us to talk about the very beginnings of the idea of the Great March of Return. Since it was first an idea or maybe a dream of yours, I know you have personally suffered from the separation created by the pseudo-borders that Israel drew in Rafah.
Yeah.
So I wanted us to talk about that. What triggered the idea in the very beginning? What was the personal motivation as well?
Yeah, the Great March of Return started as a dream. I personally, like my people, all my people, we dream to be free, to have our freedom to move, to have our human rights. Gaza is a real prison. Gaza just 141 square miles. You can see from the same point, if you were on the 10th floor, you can see the west limit the sea with Israeli warships, which prevents anyone to get out or to come in. And from the same point, you can see the east fence, which it's closed. The majority of the Palestinians in Gaza are deprived from their movement, their freedom. They never left Gaza in all their lives. 70% from the Palestinians in Gaza are refugees. So the people in Gaza are suffering so much because of the expulsion, then because of the occupation, then because of the siege, the blockade. The March of Return, its idea was a scream for life, a knock on the doors of the prison. When I wrote my first post on January 7th, 2018, I said, we want life. We want nothing but life. We are here inside Gaza. We are dying slowly and silently. So enough for this. Let us try. Let us knock the doors of the prison. People responded to this invitation because no choice. It's the normal right for anyone to get his freedom, to feel his dignity, to get his basic human rights. Unfortunately, Israeli occupation soldiers use the lethal violence against these unarmed people, unarmed protesters. They killed until now more than 260 unarmed protesters. Mm-hmm. And until now, they wounded more than 25,000 of these unarmed protesters. But what people inside Gaza can make, they have no choice but to continue to scream, to say to the world, we want life. Enough for this slow and silent death.
And I know you have a personal story with Rafah.
Yeah.
And how Rafah was divided. Do you mind sharing that with our listeners?
Rafah was one city. Then in 1982, Israeli government divided it between Egyptian Rafah and Palestinian Rafah. Mm-hmm. The barbed fence, they put it across the same house, the one house and the one land. So a lot of families, thousands of families, were separated because of this fence. Mm-hmm. One of these families was my family. Mm-hmm. I was born after 2 years from this division in 1984. I was born in Egyptian Rafah. Mm-hmm. My mother's family lived, and my father lived in Palestinian Rafah. So my father and my mother divorced mm-hmm. in that year. Then after I was born, I moved to Palestinian Rafah and I lived with my father. Mm-hmm. The house of my mother was just maybe 150 meters mm-hmm. far from me. But I cannot be able to arrive it for 19 years. Mm. The first time I arrived to the house of my mother was in 2005 when the Israeli army pulled out from Gaza. Then the borders opened just for 3 days. And in that 3 days, I arrived to my mother.
You were starting to describe what people see if they get on the 10th floor of a building in terms of the borders and how Gaza is a small, very small piece of land. I wanted you to describe a little bit how the border looks like and where people protest as part of the Great March of Return, kind of the geography of it. People are basically protesting on different sites along the border. Can you give an idea of what that looks like?
The fence separates between the Palestinians inside Gaza and between their towns and villages where they were expelled in 1948. This is why the Palestinians inside Gaza feel desire to share in these protests. When they shared, they can see their villages. They destroyed villages beyond the fence. There are five spots alongside the fence from Rafah to Beit Hanun in the north. Then the protesters collect every Friday and they protest there peacefully, no threat against the Israeli soldiers, and they practice some activities, social, cultural, songs, dabka, to keep the idea of the return in their hearts and in the hearts of the new generation. Mm-hmm. Israeli soldiers, Israeli snipers, usually use the violence against these protesters, not because they feel they are under threat, but for political reasons, because Israel doesn't want from the Palestinians to remind the world about the major problem, about the major question. The March of Return remembers the world that there are refugees, and these refugees, since 70 years, they are still struggling for their right to return. And it's their normal right, and it's achievable right. It's not just theoretical question. It's achievable right. Why? Because 85% from the lands of these refugees inside what is now Israel is still until now empty, mm-hmm. or with low density. So they can return. They can return. But why Israel prevent them? Israel prevent them for racial reasons, because they are not Jewish. And this is the problem. We believe in equality. We believe in justice. We believe in citizenship. We want a democratic country where all the people, Israelis and Palestinians, can live peacefully, can live with equal rights. We understand the right of the Israelis to live peacefully and to live in safe. But simply, don't solve your problem or don't solve your disaster by creating another one.
So we have talked a little bit about why the march was triggered. Jihad, I wanted you to talk about the political context in which the march came about. You have written before about this, and you describe that as the genesis of the Great March of Return. Can you explain kind of the political climate that gave birth to the march?
Yes, the Great March of Return unfolded in a political context where a new generation of Palestinians, young Palestinians, wanted to think and exercise their politicization outside of the existing boxes of Palestinian factional politics in light of a divided Palestinian body politic. But also it came in a moment where Palestinians have been feeling an existential threat as a result of, one, the ascendancy of Trump into power in the U.S. and what that meant for Palestinian rights and the future of the Palestinian cause. As Trump was establishing his administration and as his policies towards Palestine and Israel were taking shape, we saw a total dismissal of Palestinian rights. We saw an assault on the Palestinian refugee question and on the right of return. We saw a drive towards depoliticizing the Palestinian issue.
In fact, we see that all the time with Gaza. It's always discussed as a humanitarian issue.
For sure. But for Palestinians in Gaza and elsewhere, there are two major issues that I think, you know, they are at the heart of our thinking and they define our struggle. And I think the refugees issue in Jerusalem, because of the symbolism and what both issues mean to us. So moving the embassy was the catalyst that started and accelerated the conversation in Gaza and beyond about what is to be done. What we as Palestinians, as young Palestinians, can we do to tell the international community and to tell the Trump administration that their attempts to basically bury our cause will not succeed? The Great March of Return also happened in a context where just 1 year after Palestinians in Jerusalem led a mass popular mobilization protest against the installation of metal detectors outside of Al-Haram al-Sharif, the Aqsa Mosque. And for Palestinians in Gaza who were watching how the power of the people was capable of actually defeating Israeli policies, that stirred a conversation on social media. Social media is the major platform now where young Palestinians like Ahmed are engaging engaging in this conversation about what action needs to be done. They talk about the major political issues and events. And before that, in 2011, there was actually an attempt to march for return, not only from Gaza, but also from almost all Arab countries that surround Palestine and also from Gaza and the West Bank. The idea of implementing, Palestinians have the right to return. It's already there in international resolutions.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of implementing return, that right, of actualizing it, has also reverberated throughout Palestinian history. I mean, after 1948, Palestinian refugees did actually try to return, and they were met by lethal force. And throughout Palestinian history ever since, there has been a conversation about when do we return, how do we return. So what happened in the March of Return was basically an attempt to implement that right, to go home, to basically march home. 2011 was also a catalyst because that was the year where the revolutions and uprisings of Arab people took place, the moment that we know as the Arab Spring.
Yeah.
And for Palestinians, the fences that separate them from their lands are their Tahrir squares. Yes, we are struggling against we have a corrupt leadership and so on. But the major problem that we're dealing with is that we are subject to a settler colonial regime that does not recognize our rights and that exercises erasure systematically against us. So the fence east of Gaza, the fence that separates Palestinians in Lebanon, for example, the refugees from going back home, is the symbol, is the daily reminder of the Nakba, the catastrophe that befell Palestinians in 1948. So a combination of factors, regional, international, and local, helped start the march and played a major role in it unfolding.
And I want to go back to something that you both touched on, which is basically people organizing and getting together.
Mm.
And for many young people, not having that chance under the leadership of Hamas and in the West Bank under the leadership of Fatah. If people paid close attention, they would notice the amazing community power that happened. Part of the Great March of Return, people put up tents, they organized cultural activities, reading circles, all sort of activities that show us basically that the march has become a space for political and cultural expression. I wanted to talk a little bit about that because that's not highlighted as much in international media coverage. And I wanted to talk about how much people felt the need for that type of political practice. I don't know if you want to say something, Jihad,
yes.
And then Ahmed from the ground, kind of also what you saw.
Let's say one thing about international media coverage when it comes to popular action in Palestine. There has been a lack of recognition and acknowledgement of people's agency on the ground. Generally, people's action is generally portrayed as by the media, which I don't really like to repeat their framing, but just to help our audience understand that Palestinians are not agents, they don't own their destiny, they're pawns of this or that faction. The fact on the ground in Gaza and in Jerusalem and also in similar movements that are taking place in the West Bank or inside Israel, for example, people organizing against demolitions in the Negev or in the Naqab or against the nation state law. There are movements that organize on a grassroots level. There are movements in almost all the corners of Palestinian existence, in the homeland and in the diaspora, where young Palestinians are taking their destiny into their own hands and organizing and trying to challenge the many obstacles that stand in their way. There is the obstacle of occupation, which causes real physical fragmentation of Palestinian existence, where people from Gaza never get to meet people from the West Bank. Ahmed just got to meet Iyad Bornat, who's a leader in the Bel'in protest movement, for example, only in Chicago just a few days ago, although they live 2 hours, I think, apart in Palestine. But those leaders, those organizers, they don't get to meet and talk and dream of and think about their political action and the future. So on the ground, you have these various manifestations of people's power, of how communities want to emphasize their identity and their presence and want to challenge the obstacles. The occupation is an obstacle, but also the Palestinian political division, the patriarchal leaderships that we have that really don't recognize and acknowledge the power of the the people. But despite that, it's impressive that in Gaza, after 11 years of blockade, where people have 4 hours of electricity, after 3 major military operations that caused so much destruction of all aspects of life, you have 20-year-old people who march to the fence and talk about a peaceful, nonviolent protest, who talk about the right of return. To be 20-year-old in Gaza today means that you were 10 years old when the blockade started. Mm-hmm. This reflects a very interesting and thriving conversation that is happening on the grassroots level, where you have organizers like Ahmed, who learned from the experiences of those who came before them, and also who engage the public. And thanks to social media, such conversations have become more accessible and easier to do today in Palestine.
Ahmed, do you want to add something?
The March of Return was an opportunity for the civil society inside Gaza to express themselves. Maybe this is the advantage of the March of Return. It was a choice of national unity, not just a choice for one political faction. Now, in the March of Return, we see the youth, we see the women, we see the artists, we see the NGOs, we see the people who believe in new ideas, not mm-hmm. the traditional factional ideas. This opportunity allows them to express themselves. The March of Return gives the people opportunity to serve their cause by his creative way. So it shows a picture of the people. Not just the picture of one group, but all the people. And I think this is one of the important things that the March of Return represents. Because in this kind of nonviolent methods, everyone, regardless mm-hmm. of his ideas, his political thoughts, he can find his place.
I guess related to that, what's mind-boggling watching this from far away is how do you organize thousands and even sometimes hundreds of thousands of people?
The March of Return wasn't a personal choice. It's the choice of all people. So when I wrote this idea, I just suggest an idea. Mm. I just sparked this idea. Then hundreds of people write about it, and then they become thousands. All of them believe in this idea and believe in this kind of struggle. I think that the general conditions, the political conditions, help this idea mm-hmm. because this is the only choice for the people inside Gaza. So we cannot say that there is one leader or one organizer, but there are a lot of people who believe in this idea, and everyone work by his own method.
And we are talking with Ahmed Aburtema, journalist, author, and organizer. He's the brain behind the Great March of Return in Gaza, Palestine. And Jihad Abu Salim, staff member of the American Friends Service Committee in Chicago. Jihad is also a historian working on his PhD at NYU. So, Jihad, you were talking about the Great March of Return being not the first time Palestinians organized themselves to march towards the borders. But this is the first time the march lasts for a whole year. Mm. Did you expect it's going to continue for this long?
I didn't expect exactly how the situation will work. But in general, I expect that the people will choose this choice and they will continue in this choice because at first this is their right. And the normal situation that the people under pressure, under occupation, under blockade, they try to break this situation. Imagine when you put a man inside the room, then prevent medicine and food from him. How can we expect he will do? Of course, he will knock the door. He will try to break this blockade. Mm-hmm. So this is the normal thing. Exactly this is the situation in Gaza. The people in Gaza, 2.2 million citizens inside Gaza, they are under blockade. This area is unlivable. According to the United Nations, Gaza Strip is unlivable just next year, mm-hmm, 2020. So what can we expect from these people? To still silent? If they still silent, this means that more deaths, more suffering, more inhuman conditions. So as the conditions that create the March of Return don't change, then we expect these people will continue in this choice. And here we can say about the role of the Palestinians and supporters outside. The people inside Gaza waits a lot of advocacy and a lot of support from all the people who struggle for freedom and who struggle for human rights across the world.
And last week, the UN released a report in which it said that Israel may have committed war crimes in Gaza, and they asked that people or that individuals involved are held responsible. In fact, they said individually and collectively should be held accountable for the death of 189 Palestinians. This covered only the period between March and December, so it didn't cover these 3 months, or now we're entering almost a year since the beginning of the march. Ahmed, you and the organizers wanted this to be a peaceful protest, and you talked about that. Unfortunately, it turned pretty bloody for people. There's a high human cost for this march. This report, I don't know if you had the chance to follow. I know you've been traveling, but did you have the chance to hear the news about this UN report?
Yeah.
And how do you think you could build on that?
Yeah, I read about this report because they invited me and I give my testimony in this report. This is important report, and it confirms what we all know before, that Israel commit crimes against humanity. And this is important report, but the next step we wait, that we should feel Israel that it's under accountable. Israel feel impunity. And as they still feel impunity, this means more crimes, more victims, more suffering for Palestinian people. So we demand the world, we demand the international community, we demand the people who love justice, who love dignity, who believe in human rights for all people. We demand them to do something, to make Israel feel that they can find, they will find the consequences of their crimes. I think Israel ignored the international will because until now, unfortunately, Israel didn't pay the price of its crimes. We should send a strong message. All the world should send a strong message for Israel that you cannot make crimes and practice siege, blockade, killing, occupation, expulsion forever.
I would like to add just one more thing. What Israel has been committing against the protesters in the Gaza Strip cannot be separated from the larger scene in the Middle East and North Africa today, where you have counter-revolutionary regimes that are assaulting people's movements. The major threat to dictatorships, to occupiers, to despots, to tyrants today in the region in general are people's movements, whether be them demand movements for freedom and equality within people's countries or movements against occupation and settler colonialism. So by shooting down peaceful protesters, Israel was sending the same message Bashar al-Assad sent to the people of Syria when he killed peaceful protesters, the same message that the Sisi regime sends when he killed peaceful protesters in Rabaa and so on, the same message that the Saudis and the Emiratis have been sending Yemenis when they drop bombs on their heads. It's a reality where those regimes, these dictatorships, those occupiers are pretty terrified of people's movements. They see a threat in them. So they think that by using excessive violence, by using such levels of discipline, that they could actually abort people's movements. But if we look around today, this excessive use of violence did not really deter the Sudanese people from protesting against their dictator al-Bashir, or people in Algeria who are protesting. So I think the Great March of Return also came at a moment to renew people's faith in the power of mass popular mobilization and peaceful protest.
Have things improved at all as a result of the march, in your opinion? Do you think the march achieved its goals?
Our struggle is long because we struggle for our freedom. We struggle for our return to our homes. We struggle for our dignity. And the March of Return as non-violent method can achieve something, but its goals will be achieved by accumulation. What we want now, we want to continue in this choice because we haven't other choices. Mm. The other choice to accept the reality of our death, to accept the reality of living under incubation, under siege, with hard conditions, with unhuman conditions. So this is our only choice. And we want to strengthen the international solidarity movement. I know there are a lot of people, they believe in dignity, they believe in freedom, they believe in justice for all people. This is our united struggle. It's one struggle for me in Gaza, and for you in United States, and for you in Europe, and for you in Africa. All of us share the same struggle. We hope this international solidarity movement strengthened more and more, and we can all together, we can make pressure against the governments which pay for Israel. This money go to Israel means more bullets. The governments support Israel by it means more stealings for the lands, more settlement, more occupation. So I think it's our united struggle. Let us make our voice louder that this money, the money of taxpayers, should directed to the education, not to the occupation, to the healing, not to the killing.
And Jihad, on that, do you, being in the U.S., you've been living in the U.S. a few years, what, in your opinion, do you feel like the response in the international community and in the U.S. here has been perhaps comparable or equal to the sacrifice of the Palestinian people, the people in Gaza?
While honoring the great work of many people who try to raise awareness on what's happening in Gaza and actually shift and change U.S. policy, I would say that, unfortunately, it's not enough what's being done. Ever since I stepped foot in this country, my quest has been to help change the conversation. Unfortunately, Gaza receives coverage only in the seasons of bombardment and what Israeli security establishment calls mowing the lawn in reference to the operations that they launch every 2 or 3 years against Gaza, in which thousands of people die and lose their homes and lives. But that's why we're here today. You know, that's why I joined the American Friends Service Committee in just last year. And my experience working for AFSC and with AFSC colleagues has been defined with the unfolding of the Great March of Return. Mm. And I'm taking this opportunity and using this privilege that I have as a Palestinian from Gaza who lives in the U.S. to help change the conversation and help shift policy. The campaign we have, Gaza Unlocked, which part of that campaign we were successful to invite Ahmed and bring him here to the U.S. The goal of Ahmed's presence here is, which we are honored by having him, is to expand the conversation, is to bring the conversation that is happening in Gaza to the U.S., to friends and foes, so that they can listen, open their hearts and minds, and be part of this conversation. And also for us to help break the siege. The siege on Gaza is not only a physical one. The blockade is also a psychological blockade that chases you. I mean, I have been living in the U.S. for 5 years. My family is still in Gaza, and I haven't been able to see them. They haven't been able to leave and come meet me. So it's been a really, really sad experience. But what's making me optimistic is the growing interest on the part of people in learning more and taking action. So for example, you know, as part of the Gaza Unlocked campaign, we have been able to reach many audiences in the U.S., talk to people, talk to elected representatives, and raise awareness on the blockade and on the history that led to Gaza's current predicament as part of the broader predicament of the Palestinian people. So Gaza Unlocked, if I invite our listeners to check the website of the campaign, it aims at doing two things. Number one, raise awareness. there is never shortage on education on Gaza.
There's plenty of resources online, a lot more than any time, I think.
Yeah, but at the same time, there is plenty of ignorance out there, which I don't think it's malicious, just people don't know for most part. And I think it's part of people's responsibility in this country to know, not because there is a moral element to it, mm-hmm. but also because of the responsibility. Americans share and have responsibility because their government supports Israel. I, as a Palestinian, my family, my younger siblings, every day when they suffer under the violence of the blockade and war, their reality is a product of this alliance between the U.S. and Israel and of the U.S. bias to Israel. So I think, and this takes us back to what Gaza Unlocked is about. Gaza Unlocked aims to, one, raise awareness and educate people about what's going on, and also invite people to have a sense of urgency regarding the situation. Everything in Gaza is collapsing. Mm-hmm. These are not words. This is real, concrete suffering and pain that has been affecting children and women and elderly and everybody who live there. The second component of our campaign is to help shift policy. So we not only educate people, we actually educate people and build friendships and connections, hoping that together, as Americans, as Palestinians in the U.S., as people of color, as people who care, progressives, that we would call upon the U.S. government, call upon our elected representatives to put an end to the blockade and to raise the important political questions such as the future of Palestinian refugees, the issue that no one wants to talk about mm-hmm. as part of the internationally imposed peace process. So, for example, one of the things we did in Gaza Unlocked, we have this small initiative, an easy thing to do that people can do in order to raise the awareness of their elected representatives and call upon them to end the blockade. So if people text this number, 91990, if they send a text to this number, 91990, and write Gaza in the text, they will receive a response mm-hmm. from AFSC with a link where they can reach their members of Congress and call upon them to help end the blockade. Mm-hmm.
I know you have also testimonies and stories from people in Gaza.
Yeah, Gaza Unlocked highlights the personal stories because, you know, we're talked about as numbers. You hear that this percentage of people in Gaza are unemployed. This number of people were killed in these operations. But these numbers, when they don't give a name, when they don't give an image, mm-hmm. sometimes they pass unnoticed. What we're trying to do, we're trying to highlight the personal experiences of people who are living under blockade. What does it mean for a young woman growing up in Gaza, like my sister, who's 17 years old, to actually experience three major operations in the past 10 years? People her age, when they write, for example, their Instagram bio, they try to write cool things. I was shocked the other day to read that my sister wrote on her Instagram bio that I am Hala, I'm 17 years old and I survived three wars. These are the experiences that define people's experiences living and growing up in Gaza. And this isn't a healthy environment for them. What we're trying to do, we're trying to change this. And it's imperative, it's important, and it's urgent. Like Ahmed said, according to the UN report that was, by the way, issued in 2012, Gaza will be unlivable in 2020. And according to many international NGOs, the threshold of unlivability has already passed, mm-hmm. given that we have 4 hours of electricity there and that 70% of people are unemployed and salaries are being cut and cancer patients are dying at the border. So I invite your listeners to take a minute and think about this tragedy that is happening and try to help us end the blockade and help the people of Gaza. Mm,
and this year marked 10 years since the major offensive known as Operation Cast Lead in end of 2008, beginning of 2009. After that, there were two more major offenses that you just mentioned. Yeah. I want us to talk a little bit about how people don't have the chance to even recover from one war and then they're hit by another. This also context of siege that has continued. How did we get here?
Since 1948, the area that would become the Gaza Strip has been under immense pressure and pain. The Gaza Strip as a region was a product of the 1948 war and a consequence of it. Before 1948, there was no such a thing as a Gaza Strip. We had the Gaza District, which was one of the biggest administrative territories in Mandate Palestine. And then suddenly, overnight, because of the war, the size of the district shrunk into the 141 square miles that we have today, and hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees from surrounding areas in the territory that would become the State of Israel fled violence and were expelled by force to what would become the Gaza Strip. So since its birth as a territory, the Gaza Strip has been defined by high population density, a mass presence of refugees, and lack of resources, because it's a very small territory that cannot afford enough resources for its population to prosper and thrive, and also because of the sense of refugehood. You know, you have people who are just waiting to go home. So since 1948, the Gaza Strip has become a stage for pain and suffering as a result of that. And then come 1967, when Israel militarily occupied the Gaza Strip, and to add insult to injury, Israeli authorities would allow Jewish settlers to actually build settlements on one-third of that already small and impoverished area. So you have, from 1967 until 2005, almost 8,000 refugees lived on one-third of the strip, while the remaining areas included Palestinian refugees and Palestinians who are already from the Gaza area. And then since 1967, what Professor Sarah Roy at Harvard described as a process of de-development has unfolded in Gaza, and that means turning the population into cheap labor that only responded to the needs of the Israeli labor market, creating a gap between those people who are descendants of farmers and peasants who became, you know, cheap workers in Israel. And then come the first intifada, where people in Gaza wanted to bring to the forefront the political aspect of the cause. As a result of the first intifada, Israel started the awful legacy of its closure policies. So the policy of the blockade go back to the early 90s, when in order to collectively punish Palestinians in Gaza for joining in the first uprising, the first intifada, Israeli authorities would impose closures that actually were described in New York Times headlines from the early 90s as siege. So you have this policy that unfolded then, and then comes Oslo with its illusions. During the second intifada, things also didn't improve, and the blockade as we know it today came to being when the international community decided they're not going to like the results of our democratic elections in 2006, and then imposed an all-out blockade in 2007. In 2007, I remember I was talking to my father, and I asked him, how long do you think the blockade will last? And he said, maybe 3 months, 5 months maximum. And I just reminded him today that it's been 11 years. Mm. The logic of the blockade is to bring people in Palestine to their knees. It didn't work. It's a policy that proved wrong, even if we look at it as a policy. And now what Israel has been doing is basically maintaining the status quo, because they don't want to deal with the real questions that concern Gaza. So they maintain the status quo, they maintain the blockade, they count the calories to prevent, you know, a mass starvation. But at the same time, they prevent Gaza from rising, from becoming the thriving economy and agricultural place it used to be before all of these strategies befell the people there.
Ahmad Abu Ertema is a Gaza-based journalist and author, and one of the main organizers of the Gaza's Great March of Return. Jihad Abu Salim is a historian and a staff member of the American Friends Service Committee in Chicago. They spoke with Mira Nabulsi. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan. On March 29th, the Center for Iranian Diaspora Studies at San Francisco State University will bring together academics, researchers, artists, and filmmakers from seven countries for a two-day conference titled 40 Years and More, International Conference on Iranian Diaspora Studies. The conference will mark the anniversary of the 1979 Iranian Revolution by understanding the ways that Iranians as exiles, immigrants, and as second and third generation hyphenated citizens of their respective nations have met with both challenges and opportunities of diaspora experience. I spoke with Dr. Persis Karim about the Centers for Iranian Diaspora Studies and the significance of recognizing and understanding the Iranian diaspora. Dr. Persis Karim holds the Neda Nobari Endowed Chair and is the director of the newly established Center for Iranian Diaspora Studies at San Francisco State University. She is also a professor in the Department of Comparative Literature.
We're fortunate enough to live in the Bay Area where there's a, you know, pretty significant concentration of Iranian immigrants, second-generation Iranian-Americans, and that we have, in a sense, reached a sort of apex in that community in that we're much more visible. We are involved in various activities, both professionally, culturally. And so this is an ideal place for the genesis of this center. Neda Nobari, who's a philanthropist who came through San Francisco State University as an undergraduate, I think about 3.5 decades ago, when she left her professional life with BB Clothing, wanted to do philanthropic work, and she established a foundation that has been giving to artists, filmmakers, cultural workers across the cultural spectrum of the U.S. And she saw fit to endow a position and a center here that focused on the Iranian diaspora. And I think her vision is really unique in that she wanted to do something a little different. There have been a proliferation of Iranian studies programs across campuses in the United States, focusing primarily on, you know, classical Persian studies, literature, and history, and the ancient and perhaps more modern history of Iran. But no one has, in a sense, saw fit to endow a position where the study of diasporas of Iran have basically taken hold in countries across the globe. It's something that's dear to my heart, of course. I got started doing it with literature, trying to emphasize the voices and experiences of Iranians in the diaspora when I was in graduate school. So when this position became available, of course, I applied for it. And I think I had this unique perspective of having been involved in this field in the United States and specifically in California in the Bay Area. So that's really the sort of marriage of two happy coincidences, me having been doing this work and her having the idea that it was time to really focus not solely on Iran, but to focus on the present and the future of people who are living outside of Iran, who connect to Iran and Iranian heritage, but perhaps are really much more of an amalgam of their experiences outside of the Iranian nation. And I think that there's a maturation of the field of Iranian diaspora studies. There are lots of really brilliant young scholars who are doing this, who've, in a sense, come after me, but are really pushed the field much further along.
I have noticed, again, this is just my observation, that much of the work and focus has been on the second and third generation of Iranians. But millions of Iranians left in the aftermath of the revolution because of political and later because of economic reasons. And many have lived in exile for decades, and many of them are getting old, and some have passed away, unfortunately. How do you look at the whole question of what is and who should be included in the diaspora studies?
I absolutely agree with you that, in a way, that first generation, and in particular the people who have been caught in the politics of post-1979 and in the politics of U.S.-Iran relations have been overlooked, and in fact they're the hinge, I think, for all the subsequent generations. So one of the things that I'm really interested in is trying to capture that first wave of immigration and diaspora, which I think precedes 1979. And so two of the projects that I'm currently preoccupied with and that I see as really important aspects of doing the public history of Iranians in a place like the United States is to emphasize those earlier histories and those perhaps unnarrativized histories. So I'm working on a documentary film right now called We Are Here, We've Always Been Here, in which I actually trying to feature many of those earlier immigrants who perhaps came here in the 60s and 70s for higher education, became very politicized by the social movements that were taking place, the civil rights movement, the struggle for ethnic and cultural studies in higher education, solidarity with Black and Latino communities, and to capture those stories and the ways in which they were transformed by their experience of being in the U.S. and made them connect back to Iran, for example, in the student movements of the 60s and 70s. So it's the Confederation of Iranian Students. So in the documentary film, I'm interviewing, I'm sure you know, Parviz Shokat, mm-hmm. who's a very important person in our Bay Area community, one of the older ones. And the idea that we have to capture those histories because they will be lost if we don't. And also, they're part of the history of immigration, but they're also part of the history of Iran. And so that's a unique moment to really document this, is that we can learn a lot about how the U.S. influenced these younger people when they first came and how that was transformed into social movements that impacted the history of Iran.
And also many people who left Iran to avoid political persecutions, or some of them who spent years in jail and they ended up in the U.S., specifically some of them, we have them in the Bay Area, they have never been part of this conversation.
I think one of the things that we're seeing is that we're at the very beginning of a disciplinary shift mm-hmm. away from the focus on Iran, and a recognition that to understand Iranian history, we can also learn a great deal from the stories of individuals and the collective stories of communities that left Iran for various reasons, because of perhaps political persecution, economic reasons, and that for me, the notion of the diaspora is much more expansive than either one discipline or one moment in time. So think of me as somebody who claims being part of the Iranian diaspora. My father came in 1946, and he came as a result of the occupation of Iran by British and Soviet troops during World War II. He was very influenced by what he saw there, and he ended up coming here by accident, but that same idea that larger historical events influences the way a person decides to immigrate or to take root in another community or culture is a very important part of thinking about diaspora, not solely as a cultural phenomenon, but also as a historical phenomenon. And that's one of the things I really am excited about, that a lot of the research that's coming out by younger scholars is very deeply rooted in an awareness of histories, imperial histories, local histories, national histories. So, for example, one of the panels at the conference is by a generation of young people who were influenced by their parents, who were deeply engaged in the social movements of Iran and had to leave Iran for political reasons, or who engaged with solidarity with Iranians inside of Iran prior to 1979. So for me, the opportunity to expand our definition of diaspora is really now, right? That we have enough critical study, and we also have enough young people who understand that it's not just an ethnic identity, it's not just a cultural phenomenon, it's also an attention to the historical.
Give us an overview of what is going to be taking place on March 29th and 30th?
Well, the conference opens technically on March 28th at the San Francisco Art Commission Gallery, where there currently is an art exhibit by four Iranian diaspora artists, curated by Bay Area artist and curator Taraneh Hemami. That is an opportunity to show this art exhibit that has been up since January. And at that opening, Supervisor Asha Safai's office will read a proclamation designating March Iranian Diaspora Month, because we have so many activities happening in the month of March, obviously because of Nowruz, the Persian New Year, but also because of this conference and several art exhibitions and galleries that have featured Iranian diaspora artists, meaning people whose work is really situated now in this context, even though they might be drawing on Iranian themes. So we open on March 28th with a reception at the San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery, and then on the 29th and 30th at San Francisco State at the Seven Hills Conference Center, we have two packed days of panels. The first day, Friday, is kind of more focused around scholarship in the disciplines of the humanities, sociology, anthropology. We end the day with an excerpt of a one-woman play called Together Tea. And then on Saturday, we open the conference again in the morning at 9 o'clock. And Saturday is more focused on the sort of arts focus. So we have a panel of filmmakers. We have a panel of artists who are participating in the art show called Once at Present at the Minnesota Street Gallery, which we are sponsoring that exhibition of 19 Bay Area Iranian diaspora artists. And that is the closing of the conference on March 30th, and it will feature a fashion show by Bay Area fashion designer and artist Hushidar Mortazavit. Very interesting guy, and deeply rooted in the Bay Area, and also draws on his father's two-day background and engages with the sort of politics of queerness and also critique of capitalism and consumptive societies. And so he's doing a fashion show, and then we close the reception with a short performance by Mohsen Namju, who's now based in Brooklyn, New York, a singer of great acclaim, singer, songwriter, poet of great acclaim, who's going to sing for us at the reception on March 30th.
So before we end, give us the website and where people can go to get more information about the conference and about future events at the center.
Okay, so the center is the Center for Iranian Diaspora Studies. If you want to register for the conference, the website is cids.sfsu.edu/conference. The website in general is all of that minus the conference, cids.sfsu.edu. There you can find out more information about the projects we're involved with, regular programming. We also have a blog called With a Trace, where we're featuring blog posts about individuals who are participating in the conference, but it's something I hope to do beyond the conference to showcase the kinds of work that people are doing across the disciplines and in communities. So the other endeavor that I want to really emphasize is to build projects that are not just within a university setting, but also draw on the support and interest of people in the community. And I think that's where we really have a lot of work to do, is to sort of understand that these are not just academic projects. They're projects to support the flourishing of communities in a time when we're under attack by the rhetoric of this current administration. And you can learn more about the art exhibits also at the same site. Our Facebook is Center for Iranian Diaspora Studies. We also have a nice Instagram account. We're featuring something called 40 Stories, both on our YouTube channel and our Instagram site, where they're short interviews with people who are in all walks of life doing interesting things. And we also have an Instagram account called This Iranian American Life, where we try to showcase the ordinary and the extraordinary and to humanize, you know, Iranians in a time when we're often conflated with these rather villainous ideas about the Middle East in general and in Iran in particular.
We will also share this information on our Twitter at @Momina_radio. Dr. Persis Karim is the director of the Center for Iranian Diaspora Studies at San Francisco State University. She is also a professor in the Department of Comparative Literature.
And that's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
Mira Nabulsi is our senior producer. Our media partner is a Status Hour podcast and Jadalia Izin. You can find us on Twitter at @Vomina_radio or listen to our past shows on iTunes or SoundCloud at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. You can also reach us by email at vominaradio@gmail.com.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
PUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Extinction Rebellion, Rupert Reed and Alison Green. In part one of this program, you heard from Dr. Rupert Reed, co-founder of Extinction Rebellion in the fall of 2018 in England. Extinction Rebellion runs parallel in time and demands to the school strike movement that has also already spread to over 100 countries. In an open letter signed by Vandana Shiva, Naomi Klein, Noam Chomsky, Bill McKibben, and many more, Extinction Rebellion states, quote, "The climate crisis is worsening much faster than previously predicted. Every single day, 200 species are becoming extinct. This desperate situation can't continue. Political leaders worldwide are failing to address the environmental crisis. International political organizations and national governments must foreground the climate emergency issue immediately, urgently drawing up comprehensive policies to address it." End quote. The goal of Extinction Rebellion is to use nonviolent resistance to bring about radical change to prevent climate collapse, loss of biodiversity, and to reduce the risk of human extinction. Here is Dr. Rupert Reed presenting these demands in more detail. He spoke on February 6, 2019, at the University of East Anglia.
Here's the demands of Extinction Rebellion. In simple terms, demand number one is tell the truth. What we all need to do. The government should tell the truth. That's why also I was so passionate last year in trying to get the BBC to start telling the truth on climate and not featuring the absolute absurdities of climate change deniers any longer as balance. And the BBC have really changed their ways quite a lot over the last year. They're still way short of where they need to be, but they've gone quite a long way in the right direction. Let's keep pushing them in that direction. Anyway, demand number one says, get the government to tell the truth. Demand number two says, we want to reduce carbon emissions in the UK to net zero by 2025. Wow, that is a real target. That is a serious ambition. If the Paris Agreement were to say something like that, then it would have some credibility in terms of actually rising to the task that we face. It's absolutely eye-watering. How would something like that be done? You couldn't do something like that by just switching to electric cars or something. Reducing to zero by 2025 in a country like this, it means things like just shutting down a whole load of power stations. It means things like just melting down a whole load of cars and turning them into something else. Doesn't mean we have to go back to living in caves. Now, don't accept any rubbish like that if anyone says to you, oh, you want us to go live in caves and sit around a candle. It's so boring. They say the same thing over and over. It's always a cave and a candle. Doesn't mean that. We can still have plenty of renewable energy and so on and so forth, but it's going to mean big changes in our way of life. It's going to mean a lot of our existing infrastructure is just going to have to go. As I say, industrial growth society as we know it is at an end. The only question is it going to be ended by an enraged nature destroying it, or is it going to be ended by us voluntarily in an action, in an extraordinary action of rapid transformation? And the third demand is very interesting. The third demand says conventional democracy has failed. What we need to do is have some kind of citizens' assembly or citizens' assemblies picked at random from the public, like juries are picked at random from the public, and then given education and helpful support and so on. We need citizens' assemblies to be involved in making the decisions about how we go about doing all of this. We need to take it out of, to some extent at least, of the hands of professional politicians and professional civil servants and get the people involved. I think this is a very exciting and important part of what Extinction Rebellion is calling for. And Extinction Rebellion, as we've heard, is doing stuff locally as well. There's yours truly at the first non-violent direct action that we did here in Norwich, where we occupied this exhibition that the council had, where they were trying to tell people about this wonderful new road that they want to build. They want to build a road across this beautiful valley near here, the Wensum Valley, and basically destroy the peace and calm of it and destroy much of the wildlife and, of course, create loads of new journeys, loads of new cars. At the exact time when we need to be massively reducing our carbon emissions. It's completely absurd, total lack of vision. So we achieved a pretty remarkable and really quite positive set of media coverages out of it. And it's not just Extinction Rebellion, by the way. I want to mention one other thing that's happening right now, which is also very exciting, of this kind of radical, unprecedented nature. Some of you may recognize the young woman on the left. She's called Greta Thunberg. She's a Swedish school student, and she started a strike because of climate change. She said, why should I go to school if the education that I'm getting is going to be irrelevant because society is going to fall apart by the time I'm middle-aged? And at first it was just her. Things have changed a bit since then. 30,000 young people. This is just one of many, many demonstrations taken to the streets. Most of those are school students. Now, one thing that's really exciting about this, some of you probably know some children, some of you probably have some children. There is a starting now of the school strike for climate movement here in this country. So if you know a kid or if you have a kid, I would suggest to you say something subversive to them. Yeah? Say to them, yeah, you know, why should you go to school every single day to be taught this irrelevant stuff if society is going to fall apart by the time you're old? It's a horrible thing that we have to contemplate saying this kind of thing to our children. It's abominable. But that is the situation we are now in. And we're starting to get to a situation where we're getting inspired by the leadership of young people who are willing to face up to this. So this, I think, goes right alongside what's happening in Extinction Rebellion. All right, so that was number five. We need to rebel. Number six, we need to talk. Because it's really, really important that we get to discuss about this. This is not a topic where it makes any sense at all to have a lecture and then to just go straight off back to your own home by yourself. You need to talk. We need to talk about this because this stuff needs to be processed emotionally, rationally, practically. It needs to not be something that gets stuck inside your head. For far too long, that's a situation that far too many of us have been in. I think that many people have been in a situation for quite a long time of kind of having this set of worries at a low level, but not really fully addressing it. We're trying to find ways of kind of coping with it that involve things like, you know, trying to study it a bit and share your worries a bit, but not too much. You don't want to make people too worried themselves. You don't want to sound like you're some kind of kook. Well, you're not a kook. This is real. And my experience is that since I started giving this kind of talk, it's actually been hugely liberating for me and hugely liberating for quite a lot of people that I've talked to. It took me a long time to get to the point of being willing to give this kind of talk. Because I was so intimidated by all the voices that were saying for so many years, you must remain optimistic, you mustn't put people off, people are going to be demoralized, people are going to be angry with you, etc. I was worried that I'd be attacked in public for giving this kind of talk at all. My actual experience has been very, very different. That over and over again, what people have said to me is, oh, thank God, We can actually be honest about this now. We can actually start facing it. We can actually start talking about it among ourselves. So that's what we need to do.
That was the conclusion of a speech by Dr. Rupert Weed, co-founder of Extinction Rebellion. Just days before producing this segment of TUC Radio, I came across an interview by scientist Dr. Rob Muir from oceanriver.org. He spoke to Dr. Rupert Weed and Dr. Allison Green, also a co-founder of Extinction Rebellion. Here are some of the highlights of their conversation.
Rupert Weed is going to be with us, and Rupert is a reader of philosophy at the University of East Anglia, chair of the UK-based think tank Greenhouse, and a former Green Party of England and Wales councillor, spokesperson, European parliamentary candidate, and national parliamentary candidate as well. Our other guest is Dr. Allison Green, is a UK cognitive psychologist in the area of human learning and skill acquisition. Allison is the former pro vice chancellor at Arden University. So, but I got to ask you for the public, why former?
Hi, everyone. Former because I took a very large decision a couple of months ago to resign from my post and swap academia for full-time activism.
Yeah, it's just remarkable. You know, because I look at your resume and you've been doing all these steps, getting higher and higher and doing more and more in academia, and then you just stepped away. Why?
I guess I had a kind of epiphany a couple of years ago, and I got to a point in my career where suddenly I realized that actually the career didn't really matter. And what really mattered to me was putting myself into something that I actually believe in and something that enabled me to maintain my integrity. I wanted to leave the system, basically. I wanted to extricate myself from the current economic system as best I could and do something that I can believe in.
And so what did you come up with to do?
Well, I became involved with Extinction Rebellion, which began its life formally late last year, although the ideas had been in development with the key founders of the group for quite some time. So that's Roger Hallam and Gail Bradbrook, I think, are the two people that were most closely associated with Extinction Rebellion. These guys really motivated and inspired me and led me to want to work with them and to bring about social change.
Yes, exactly. And so that's why you're featured on this show to talk about the Extinction Rebellion.
It started some time ago, I think, with Gail primarily, who had been an activist and who had been trying to facilitate and encourage mass civil disobedience. And then last year, things seemed to gel. And so in October, on October 31st last year, there was a declaration in London. And this was then followed by a number of events in London. The movement is unusual in that it's grown remarkably quickly, but it has at its core some principles that I think will resonate really with a lot of people. And they're things like telling the truth about climate and the ecological emergency. You know, and I think most people can identify with that because, you know, the truth is absolutely fundamental. You know, what is wrong with telling the truth? A second requirement is that the government enacts legally binding policy measures. And then a third one is that we bring about a citizens' assembly to oversee changes as part of a sort of creating a democracy. And those are the three core principles that I think have really sparked the imagination of a lot of people from academics to young people, to grandparents. They're the kinds of things that people can really believe in.
Can I just add that the demand for legally binding policy measures, it's the precise demand in the UK context, and I think it would be similar in the US context, is for this country to go carbon net zero by 2025, which is an incredibly bold demand. It looks completely unrealistic according to the rules of the political system as we know it. It requires everything to be changed in a short space of time. But that is actually what we need. This is one of my favorite demands that we in Extinction Rebellion are making. we're saying, yes, everything has to change really fast. And that's why we need to do really radical things to get there. It's not going to happen if we just stick to the conventional political process. It's not going to happen if we just stick to trying to vote for the best candidates at elections. That can help, but it isn't going to get us to zero carbon by 2025. So I think that demand of the Extinction Rebellion really concentrates the mind and really shows why we need to be engaging in mass civil disobedience. So yeah. Non-violence is completely central to the movement. And as Alison just said, also, we want democracy. We want real democracy. We're saying that representative democracy as we know it has failed. So let's have some citizens' democracy. Let's have some sortition is the technical term for it. It's like what you do with a jury. A jury is selected at random from members of the public. We should have a citizens' assembly like that, where people are selected at random to represent us all, as a jury does. And then they're given some help and some education and some information and facilitated in deliberating about what we should do. Frankly, they couldn't do any worse than the current bunches of politicians we've got in our countries. So let's give that kind of radical version of democracy, let's give that kind of idea a chance.
So that means you have to be open to diverse approaches to getting there. You're not just all walking step in the same, you know, kind of together. I mean, that you're trying to be a big tent, right, and involve different views and stuff?
Yeah, and you're trying to open to new and radical possibilities. Of course, a lot of what we do is going to have to be done by really, really working together, more closely together than we ever have done before. We have to want to do that. We have to do it more or less voluntarily. That's what real democracy means, and that's part of what Extinction Rebellion wants to facilitate, real democracy and nonviolent rule of the people, by the people, for the people.
Oh, over to you, Isabel. I'm going to have a question.
Alison, you mentioned earlier that there were some events organized in London. Can you tell us the first big action taken there as part of the Extinction Rebellion mission and movement?
And for me, this was a first too. So I participated in what we're calling the Bridges event. And this took place on November 17th in London. And, you know, this was a big ambition. So the plan was that people would descend upon London and we would arrange ourselves on five bridges simultaneously. And then when a signal was given, we would then just swarm into the roads and we would just stop. We would simply stop the traffic. And, you know, for a lot of people there, you know, I was there on the day on Waterloo Bridge. I know Rupert was there too. Being there and actually talking with the people about why they were there and their motivations and what mattered to them was, you know, was really quite an incredible experience. You know, the UK hasn't seen this kind of action, this kind of commitment from normal people to simply congregate and to actually take action, non-violent action, in this particular way. We haven't seen this kind of thing in a long, long time. So it was quite an experience, I have to say, you know, to actually just be there and then to look across the Thames, across to the other bridges. The atmosphere was quite euphoric in a way, which sort of seems somehow not quite appropriate for an event that was a very serious event. I mean, these were people who are passionate, absolutely passionate about what's happening in the UK and across the globe, and who are saying, you know, we've had enough. We are going to rise up and we are going to make ourselves heard. It was a very empowering experience from my perspective. I mean, Rupert, I know you were there. Perhaps you want to say something too?
Yeah, well, my experience was very similar. I was on Lambeth Bridge and I was helping to try to sort of organise the taking of the bridge. The atmosphere before we tried to go into the road, frankly, it was pretty nervous. I was really quite uncertain that it was going to work out. And then Roger Hallam, who was on Lambeth Bridge with me, and one or two of the others started walking out into the road. He just started strolling into the road. And then we all started following. And we just found how incredibly easy it was for hundreds of us to occupy this bridge and stop the traffic, bring central London to a standstill, reduce economic activity, and how the police couldn't really stop us because there were so many of us. And as you say, Alison, part of the atmosphere was, as a result of this, euphoria. It's like, wow, we can do it. 6,000 people took nonviolent civil disobedience and occupied the bridges of central London. And if we've done that once, well, we can do it again, and we can do it again on an even larger scale. And that is indeed what we're planning to do in April.
Yeah, and I recommend people go to your website.
The correct website address is simply rebellion.earth.
If you want to follow along with what Alison and Rupert are talking about, it's a great site to visit. Oh, Alison, you had an event that involved burying a coffin?
It did. So November 17th was really a very symbolic event. It was about expressing feelings, expressing anger. The following event on November 24th in Parliament Square was really, it was a grieving event. It was where people came together to talk about their feelings, to talk about how we feel about, you know, the loss of the Arctic sea ice, the loss of so many species. Oh, you know, it's tragic to how we feel about the forthcoming loss of even more species. And Skeena Rathore has been, in many ways, you know, the heart and soul of Extinction Rebellion. And she talked very passionately and emotionally about how one of the hardest things she'd had to do was explain to her teenage daughter that she might not have the longevity that she would wish for. And hearing these impassioned speeches from various people, Rupert spoke too, it was incredibly moving. And it culminated in there was a march and there was also a symbolic burial of a coffin. These kinds of actions where people talk about, you know, about feelings, where there's a deep kind of spiritual core to the movement, this is incredibly unusual. This hasn't really been seen before.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think this is a unique dimension of Extinction Rebellion. We're giving people a space which is so needed for the expression of feelings of grief and loss and terror. And these things have been suppressed in the environmental movement far too often. The environmental movement for far too long has said things like, oh, we have to be optimistic. We always have to give people something positive to look towards. And it means that we've been very inauthentic often in the environmental movement. The Extinction Rebellion is blowing through all of that. We're saying, stuff that. Let's be honest. It's time to tell the truth, which is the demand we're also making, as Alison said, of the government. So we'd better do it ourselves. It's time to tell the truth about our fears. It's time to tell the truth about our feelings. It's time to tell the truth about what we want. And what we actually find is that liberates people and empowers people to become much stronger and much less fearful. And it leads people, for example, to make the extraordinary, brilliant decision that Alison has made, which has really made me think, I must tell you, of chucking in this amazing job that she has so that she can try to do the right thing for the future of the planet. It's a liberation that's going along with this kind of authenticity and this facing of the reality of what we've done. You know, the horrendous fact that during my lifetime, we have exterminated half of wildlife on Earth. Mind-blowing, terrible fact. If you don't feel really sad when you hear that statistic, there's something wrong with you. So there has to be a place in our movement for that sadness. And in Extinction Rebellion, there definitely has been. And November the 24th, as Alison says, was a superb expression of that. It's called Rebellion Day 2, if people want to look it up on the internet.
I think, Hunter, we got a question. We also hit on the idea of doing things at a local level. Do you guys want to talk about what Extinction Rebellion is doing with local communities?
It's important to understand that Extinction Rebellion is quite a decentralist organization. So local groups, local affinity groups, and local groups generally have a strong right to do whatever they want, provided they stay within the overall frame of the principles of Extinction Rebellion and especially the fundamental method of nonviolence. So where I live in Norwich, we've been very active. We occupied and blocked a exhibition where the local council were trying to promote a horrible new climate dangerous road that they want to build. We nonviolently protested there and effectively blocked this exhibition from happening. We've also been working hard to try to persuade our local councils to declare a climate emergency, which is happening as a result of Extinction Rebellion in more and more places around Britain and, in fact, around the world. These local events are happening all over the place, as Alison says, more and more of them. And then there are also going to be the big national and indeed international events, with the key one being on April the 15th, which everyone is working towards.
Alison, there was a letter from academics that you could maybe start us off on, and then Rupert could comment on that as well.
Yeah, one of the things that I think has been hugely effective in terms of getting Extinction Rebellion on the radar and bringing awareness to it was the initial letter that Rupert, Richard House and I composed. If you look at it, it's on the Guardian website. It's very visceral, you know, because we are all, the three of us, incredibly passionate about what's happening and what's not happening. And just how important it is that, you know, that action is taken. And so being academics, you know, we thought, well, academics need to have a voice. You know, the public trust, they trust academics, they tend to trust experts. So we reached out to our academic networks
across a huge number of different disciplines. So we weren't reaching out simply to climate scientists. We were reaching out to people from the arts and the humanities, sciences and theology, philosophy, you know, a broad church. It was remarkable because, you know, people would willingly sign up, many of them saying, fantastic, you know, we really support what you're doing. It's about time. We've needed this. And that letter was really a turning point for Extinction Rebellion. It was cathartic. It's proven to be a catalyst. It's had that letter has had some 16,000 downloads, I think, from The Guardian, which is, you know, if you think of it, this is it, in one sense, it's just a letter. In another sense, I think it marked a point at which academics were saying, we are no longer sitting on the fence. You know, we are standing up and we're going to make our voices heard.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we then followed that up with a second letter in December, which was an international letter, which was again headed up by Alison and Richard House and myself. And this international letter had a lot of signatories that your listeners will recognize, people like Vandana Shiva, Naomi Klein, Noam Chomsky, Philip Pullman, Bill McKibben, Jonathan Porritt, Lily Cole, Chris Packham, a real retinue of international stars of the Green Movement and of broadcasting and of media and of dissent. And what this international letter did was follow on the initial letter and say, look, this obviously is something of concern to us around the world. And around the world, we need organizations, we need movements like Extinction Rebellion to be taking off in a big way if we are to have a future. It really is as simple and as blunt as that. We're delighted that these letters seem to have had this kind of involving and catalyzing effect upon people. And that's part of the reason, I think, why we are seeing this extraordinary international development of Extinction Rebellion. I think officially now there are groups in 127 countries, which is really quite incredible. And what we're hoping, among other things, is that in the US, Extinction Rebellion is really going to grow and take off in the next few months and hopefully rise to the kind of level that it's already risen to in Britain.
Let's kick back a bit. And Rupert, tell us about kind of the philosophical underpinnings of this whole kind of these kind of endeavors of trying to repair nature and how complicated it all is. And
well, there's so much to say here, but let me just mention a couple of key things. Firstly, as we've already implied, and this is a very important point, the Extinction Rebellion is not just about dangerous man-made climate change. It's not just about climate breakdown. It's about the wider ecological crisis of which climate breakdown is simply the biggest and most immediately existentially threatening symptom for us, for humans. But we have to remember that actually the extinction crisis and the biodiversity crisis are hitting already the planet unbelievably hard and rendering other species extinct at an almost unprecedented rate. And this is all down to us, and mostly not down to climate, actually. It's mostly down to habitat destruction and sheer human numbers and level of human consumption and production and pollution more generally. Extinction Rebellion is concerned about the possible extinction of the human race and the actual extinction of other beings across our planet. And we want absolutely to stop both of these things.
That was, again, the voice of Dr. Rupert Reed. Before him, Dr. Alison Green, both co-founders of Extinction Rebellion. A much longer version of this interview is posted on the podcast page of oceanriver.org. Dr. Rupert Reed teaches philosophy at the University of East Anglia. He's a longtime Green Party politician and a former Green Party spokesperson for transportation. Dr. Alison Green was most recently pro-vice chancellor at Arden University. Last year, she made the transition from academic to activist. She co-wrote the open letter from Extinction Rebellion that was published in The Guardian. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
To the archives of Radio Curious, I'm Barry Vogel. Mariah W. Stewart was a free black woman who lived in Boston, Massachusetts from the early 1820s to the early 1840s. She was the first American-born woman to lecture in public on political themes and likely the first African-American to speak out in defense of women's rights. A forerunner to Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth, she was intensely religious and regarded as outspoken and controversial. For more than a century, Mariah W. Stewart's life contributions have remained obscure, illustrating the double pressures of racism and sexism on the lives of African-American women. I met with Mariah W. Stewart in the person of Chautauqua scholar Professor Sandra Kamasukiri during the 1996 Democracy in America Chautauqua programs held in Ukiah, California. This program was originally broadcast in November of 1996. In this interview, I spoke first with Mariah W. Stewart and then with Professor Kamasukiri. We began when I asked Ms. Stewart to comment on the differences between the lives of free black women in the North and women who were slaves in the South.
I often spoke of this subject in my lectures when I spoke before the people of Boston in the 1830s. In my view, there was very little difference between the free Africans in the North and those enslaved in the South. True, it is true that we are not under the lash of the slave driver, but what can be worse than the slavery of the spirit and the slavery of the mind, which is what we free Africans endure in the North?
My understanding is that although you weren't physically tortured under the lash, you were still living in segregated communities.
This is true.
And bound out as young children to work in a defined form of work. You didn't have a choice.
We did not have a choice. Many people have spoken to me and said that during my time, white children were bound out, or they used the term apprenticed. Yes, this is true. They were apprenticed into jobs and work, but these were things that would give them a good livelihood later on in their life. They were apprenticed as printers and people of special trades. But the children of free Africans, we were always bound out or apprenticed as boot blacks, as laundresses, as seamstresses, work that we would have to continue once we were released from being bound out. And we had no choice. There were only set jobs that we were apprenticed to, if you want to use that term.
You had to continue because this was the way of making money that you learned? A person was too old to learn something else?
Young women were bound out until they were 15 or 18 years of age. Young men were bound out until they were 21 years of age. And so by then they had learned this way of work and way of living, and they continued with it. But there is something more, that of the free Africans in Boston, most of the women were domestics. They were servants, and most of the men were laborers. When we tried to seek other types of work, we were turned away. In fact, let me tell you this story. On one occasion, I went to some of the white women in the community who owned businesses, and I said to them, "What if I should bring you some young African women with the best of credentials and references? would you hire them? Would you have them work in your business? And they said to me, well, yes, we would hire them if it was up to us. But since it is not the custom, we fear that we would lose our public patronage. What a horrible thing this is, prejudice, that they would not hire these young women.
And what was done about it? What could you do? For example, was the African American Female Intelligence Society a way of addressing this?
The African American Female Intelligence Society, that's a group that I spoke to in 1832, and that was the year that they were formed. This group of strong women was dedicated to improving the life of Africans in the community and to moral uplift. And they did several things. Oftentimes they gathered together food and clothing for the people in the community who had none. They also gathered together to help each other learn to read and write. They were also a literary society where they read books together and helped each other in the area of education. They were a very noble group. But they were not a group who were able to, let's say, create jobs for the African people.
But were they a group that was able to go to the white community and stress this issue of equal employment for African people?
They could stress this, but one thing you must understand is there was so much hatred against us at that time, is that I believed, and I often said this to my audiences, there is no people on the earth as despised as we Africans in America. And it is a thing that saddened my heart. And so, since it was difficult to get jobs, one of the things I said to my audiences is that we must create our own. I said to them, if the whites will not give you a license for a store, then you must build your own store. Put groceries on one side and dry goods on the other side. And many people said, but we cannot get an education. And I went to the women. And these were women who were members of the African American Female Intelligence Society. And I said, save your money. And in time, if you save your money, all of you, and put it together in time, you will be able to lay the cornerstone for a school. And we will be able to teach our own children. So I urged people to work together to build and to get their own money.
I'm interested in the genesis of the hatred. Why were the African people hated? Particularly in the North, where they were allowed to be free.
Free to an extent. A gentleman who spoke in your community earlier this week, a man by the name of Alexis de Tocqueville, in his book, Democracy in America, he observed, he said that nowhere is the hatred of the black greater than in those places that have never seen slavery, places such as the North. And I believe this to be true. And I try to understand, perhaps it is because they see us as people who will take the jobs from them. And so it is easy to identify us by the color of our skin. And so they have that anger. I know that in the North, there was some anger because during the Revolutionary War, not a long time before my time speaking in Boston, a mere 50 years or so, Massachusetts and other states in the North held slaves. These were slave states. And during the Revolutionary War, there were 60,000 African slaves who fled with the British and helped the British. Perhaps that is some of the anger. But I think it's a number of things that make for the hatred and the anger. But it is hatred that is unwarranted. Because we people of color, we have the same love of liberty and justice as the whites.
And throughout your life, until your death in 1879, you saw this hatred ebb and flow and continue through the Civil War until almost 15 years after the Civil War.
I saw many changes. I know this. While there was hatred in my lifetime, I always met individuals. I cannot say that I hate whites. There were many evil things that were done against me. In fact, when my husband's estate was taken from me, when I was cast out into the street, I saw the evil ways of white men spreading themselves like the green bay tree. But through my lifetime, I also saw some of that evil wither like the grass. and die like the herb on the desert. So I know that these people, I know that one day they will have to stand before God. I know that God will take care of the African people. And these people who have done us such injustice, on that day of judgment, those people, they will call out to the rocks and the mountains to hide them.
Tell us how it was that the estate of your husband after his death was taken from you.
Oh, that was such a sad thing. I watched my husband suffer until the day that he died, and I was so grieved and my heart was broken. I'd asked God to spare his life, but on December 15th of 1829, my beloved husband died. We were married barely 3 years, and I lost him. And then 2 days later, on December 17th, 1829, a man who owned a tailor shop on the same street as my husband, a man by the name of Daniel B. Badger, he came into court with a document that he said was my husband's will. My husband owned a prosperous business in one of the most well-to-do sections of Boston, the Broad Street area. This will said that my husband's property, his entire estate, had been willed to this man, Badger. And the only thing that my husband willed to me was a bed and the bedclothes on it. And our last name was spelled incorrectly in this document. I was so shocked while the judge threw out that will. But just a few days later, the same man returned with a list of names. He said my husband had never paid his bills, and the judge gave my husband's entire estate to this man, and I was left absolutely penniless and homeless. And do you know, later on in my life, a friend of mine who was present in the court found this man Badger's false will and my husband's will. They were both on file in that court. Now, I know that it was often a common thing for those Africans with property to lose that property when one member died. And as a woman, as an African woman, I was not allowed to speak out in court. There was nothing I could do.
Were there any white people to whom you could go to speak a defense for you? Was that socially acceptable for you and the white community at that time?
It was not socially acceptable, because those whites who spoke out in defense of blacks, they paid a terrible price. One of my dearest friends, lifelong friends, is the famous William Lloyd Garrison, the editor of the newspaper, The Liberator. And there were times for simply operating that newspaper that spoke out against the injustices and the horrors of slavery, there were times when his life was threatened. There were times when he was beaten in the street. So it was not a safe thing for whites to do.
Beaten in the street because he spoke out for equality for Africans,
yes,
and white people.
Yes, absolutely. His life was often threatened.
Let me ask you about Liberia and the creation of the country of Liberia on the west coast of Africa. But first, I want to say that my guest this week is Mariah W. Stewart, a free black woman who lived in Boston from the 1820s to the 1830s, and who was also the first American-born woman to lecture in public on political themes, and likely the first African-American to speak out in defense of women's rights. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Tell us about your feelings on the creation of Liberia, which I believe was created in about 1822.
Exactly. It was created by the United States in 1822, and it was created as a colony on the west coast of Africa, and its purpose was to serve as a place to which Americans could send free Africans. In the 1830s in America, there were 2 million Africans, and about 3% of those were free. Africans overall made up about 18% of the American population. And there was a feeling among slaveholders in particular that the presence of free Africans in America was a threat to slavery, is that those people enslaved could look at those who are free and wish for their own freedom. And in fact, the majority of free Africans lived in the southern states of the United States. And so a group of people began a movement which they called the American Colonization Society, and its goal was to send all free Africans back to Africa, particularly to Liberia. They engaged in many means. There were community groups of whites who raised money to buy the passage for free Africans. There were some legislatures in different states that used state money to buy the passage for free Africans. And they would send agents into our community. And this angered me so much.
Agents to do what?
Agents to persuade free Africans to go back
to return
to Africa. And in one of my speeches, I stood before my audience and said that I am an American, and before I'll be sent to a strange land, I would rather be pierced through with the bayonet. I refused to go, and I spoke out against it. Now, there were some slaveholders were in support of the colonization movement, but there were also some abolitionists who were in favor of the colonization movement. Some of them believed, with right reason, that free Africans would not be safe in America, so it was better for them to go to this new homeland, as it were, and start another life. And other abolitionists believed that slavery should be ended gradually, and as slaves are freed one by one, then those free, newly freed slaves should then be sent immediately back to Africa.
On a visit that I made to Liberia in 1984, many of the people I spoke with talked about the problems of the colonization of Liberia in that it was colonized with people who came from all parts of the African continent and were put together in a small colony in Liberia. And they brought with them different languages and different cultures and different histories, including the slaves and the free Africans, and that they felt this created a very, very difficult situation. And then, in 1984, I was told that many of the political leaders of Liberia were the descendants of the slaves, as opposed to the people who had lived there indigenously. And I'm wondering what the thought was, if there was one, of the people from North America, the African people, who were going back to Africa about being part of this mix.
I'm pleased to hear that this colony still exists in your time. I'm very saddened to hear that there have been problems with it. During my time, I think there was no thought as to what we would do once we were there. Perhaps the thought that we would be like the pilgrims, that we would work there and we would make a new land, a new home. The thought was to remove us from America.
Without forethought as to what the new home would be like.
Without forethought.
Mariah Stewart, I want to thank you for joining us here on Radio Curious, and I wish that we had a little more time. But before we go, I want to ask you the question that I ask all of my guests at this point in an interview, and that is, could you tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
An interesting book. Is it possible for me to name two?
Please.
Okay. I would say an interesting book, and this is a book that I always shared with my audiences and it surprised them, is a book called The Fair Sketches of Women, which was published, written by a man named John Adams in 1790. And in this book, Mr. Adams talks about the rich history of women across the centuries. He talks about the women in the 1500s who were warriors and poets and divines and scholars who read and studied in Hebrew and Greek. And I often said to the members of my audiences that we must work so that such women can rise up amongst us now.
Is that John Quincy Adams?
This is a man from England by the name of John Adams.
Not the American.
Not the American. Okay.
And the other book?
And the other book. It's the greatest book of all, and I urge all people to read this book. It's a book that changed my life, and that book is the Bible.
Mariah W. Stewart, thank you for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you. It has been an honor for me to be here.
And Sandra Kamusakiri, welcome to Radio Curious.
Yeah, this is great. This is a great program. I'm really pleased to have the chance to speak to you, Barry.
Well, I'm really happy that you're here. Tell us about how you fit or chose or were chosen to be the character of Mariah W. Stewart.
I think it's somebody's insight or one of those great things that sort of makes a turn in your life to something mm-hmm. new. The group that put this program together is a group called the Inland Empire Education Foundation.
This is the Democracy in America Chautauqua.
Exactly, that organized, that wrote the grant for, conceptualized the Democracy in America tour. And a nice group of people, less than half a dozen, who said that people are always complaining how things are sort of going to rack and ruin in America and in communities, so let's do something about it. And through their own initiative, they put this together. Now, I was working for them as a consultant. They were developing other 19th century African American characters. I teach African American literature, so I was sitting and mm-hmm. helping them with the accuracy of the characters. They kept asking me to play Mariah Stewart, and I kept saying no. I've never done anything like that. I'm a teacher, and I can't even imagine it. And as I kept watching, I became more and more fascinated, and then I volunteered to audition to play Stewart. They had a national call mm-hmm. For all seven characters, so I went through their very, very rigorous audition process. And they selected me, and it's been a thrill. It's been one of the greatest things. It's a thrilling thing to do Chautauqua.
I understand that when you were doing a Chautauqua program as Mariah in Southern California, there was a person in the audience who really believed that you were a preacher and came up and asked to be blessed.
Oh, that was astounding. It's moving. Sometimes when we do these characters, there are people in the audience who are able to suspend their disbelief. But I began speaking as Stewart, and one section I talk about Stewart's conversion and her belief in God, her dedication of her life to speaking for God. And in the midst of that part, a man got up out of his seat, walked forward, stood in front of me, and bowed his head and put my hand on his head. Now, people around, this is America, we're getting nervous and we're getting about ready to pounce on him. But then someone said, he wants you to bless him. And there was a minister in the second row who called out the blessing. I repeated the blessing with my hand on this gentleman's head. And then he looked up at me, he shook my hand, and he walked away. It was the most moving thing for me.
Tell us how you felt, the movement, the call on you to bless him.
When I looked at him, when he put my hand on his head, you know, there's that moment. He wasn't a kook. He wasn't drunk. He wasn't drugged, as some people thought. And I looked in his eyes, and he was a human being and had such nice eyes, and he believed. But on another level, so I was saying, okay, believe in God. As a character, I believe in God. I dedicated my life to God. But then on another level, that's not acting. That's also truth. And mm-hmm. it was truth for him. And so in that moment, there was no performance. There was no character playing. And I was really honored to do that for him. I mean, he also gave me a gift also, that I could have that effect, that positive effect on people.
I can see that in your eyes as we sit here and talk.
Yeah, it was quite a moment.
Yeah. I want to ask you, as the scholar, the genesis of the hatred in America that you spoke of as Mariah, and that I fear that you probably have experienced in your own life mm-hmm. towards African people.
Sure.
Now up into the 1990s.
Yeah. You know, America's racial history is so complicated, and it's so tangled. And sometimes I don't know where to start. When I teach African American literature, and we're in the 19th century, and talking about literature near and around the Civil War, sometimes I talk about it on a psychological level. Is that when you wrong another person, just in your daily life, when you wrong another person and you do it knowing that you're wronging them and you hurt them grievously, then one of the things you fear is what? You fear that somehow they're going to get back at you. And so during this time, you've got 2 million blacks, by the time of the Civil War, 14 million blacks, most of whom have been enslaved. And people knew, they knew in their hearts that this was not right what they were doing. And so one fear is the human reaction, these people are going to get back at us. So I think there's the psychological fear. I also think there's the fear of guilt. Also, when you hurt someone, you feel guilty afterwards. And most people, that's not a good a thing to feel. They find ways to avoid it. And one way is to shut out that thing that you've hurt. Another is, I think in the 90s, we're living with this legacy because the decision to end slavery, contrary to popular belief, was not a moral decision made by the American people. If it had been a moral decision, people rising up as a group and saying, this is wrong, this is immoral, we don't want to do it anymore, I don't think we would have the legacy of hatred. It was not a moral decision. It was a war maneuver by President Lincoln to end slavery. So I think we have the legacy because it was not something that was decided in the psyche, the hearts, the minds of Americans. It was one president's, with his advisors, legal maneuver. This will disrupt the South if we free all these people. The South was using blacks as labor to help in their war effort. So I think it's a lot of factors. I think it's economic. I mean, I could really get into capitalism, which depends on a large labor base with a small pool at the top of haves. Yeah. So I think it's lots of factors. It's something, I think it's something, though, we're going to have to sort out because, my last point on this, because of this, is that when you say, let's just take blacks, when you say that blacks are not human, then that means that the person who says that, that when you say that, you have lost the ability to recognize the humanity in another person. Now, when you have lost that ability, it shows up in other areas. So we as a nation, we can say that America has an anti-black climate right now, but that inability to recognize the humanity in another person carries over into other areas. So we have problems with gender issues. We have problems recognizing the humanity in our children and recognizing how they need to be protected. We have problems respecting our elderly and seeing them as human. We have problems respecting those who are disabled and handicapped. So it carries over into other areas. And these are things we're going to have to rectify if we're going to be a healthy nation.
Sandra, I'd love to talk more, but we're running out of time, and I want to ask you the same question I always ask at the end of an interview. Could you tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
Oh, an interesting book that I've read lately. You know, I would recommend that that someone read Mariah Stewart's speeches and her book. It's in a book, The First Black Political Writer in America, edited by Marilyn Richardson, and she has an incredibly wonderful, lengthy introduction that sets the historical background and context of life of free blacks in Boston in the 1830s. So I would recommend that one. Learn more about Mariah W. Stewart.
Sandra Kamusakiri, thank you for joining us on Radio Curious.
Yeah, thank you, Barry Vogel. It's an honor to be here.
This archive edition of Radio Curious, Professor Sandra Kamusakiri portrayed Mariah W. Stewart, a free black woman who lived in Boston, Massachusetts from the 1820s to the early 1840s. This program was originally broadcast in November of 1996. The books that Mariah W. Stewart recommended are The Fair Sketches of Women by John Adams and The Bible. The book that Sandra Kamusakiri recommends is Mariah W. Stewart, America's First Black Woman Political Writer, Essays and Speeches by Marilyn Richardson. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.